The monster is a mirror, and when we look at him, we look into our own hidden faces. Meditate on this at second level.
No, I will not go to second level. I will not go to second level with you. I will not be one mind with you. I know what May wants with that. No! The vortex is an obscenity. I know. I hate all women. Birth. Fertility. Superstition.
Friend is beyond redemption.
No. No.
Renegade.
Friend is renegade.
He must be cast out. He is no longer one with us.
Renegade.
Cast him out.
No.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 12th of April 2024, streaming from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora and not Google for reasons that should be blindingly obvious. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after everyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III wage slavery lies. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, these so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, they're stacking up nicely. Twisted accelerationist Armageddonist policies designed to make every crisis worse. And the politicians, as Manfred Petrich used to say, have nothing to say. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks, want us as slaves to their machines. Huxley's diabolical plan rewards only blind obedience, folks. Meanwhile, the pantheist, wife-murdering WEF king, Tampon Charlie, is waging war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, with regime change maniac sidekick and referendum failure, and also the guy who, along with Clegg, basically destroyed most of Britain through cutting public service, massive amounts of cuts, for example, to the Environment Agency. All these things that are supposed to be looking after our country. That's Diddy David Cameron cut all that, and now he's Foreign Secretary, courtesy of King Charles and Goldman Sachs. Dave's away again for next week too, as well as Martin. So, we'll be back as a team, we hope, in May. But to begin this week, I'll just run through some of the items that we've got for you. So looking at the local elections, it's the deadline's just passed for people standing in those elections. We're hearing from Piers Corbyn about his attempt to stand in London, and also some of the successful tactics that have been used over the years standing in local government. We'll be having a very good look at the world of BlackRock and Vanguard and private equity, and how they're basically buying up our governments, they're buying up everything, but particularly the farming that they're moving in on right now. So we'll be hearing a lot about that. A special look with Sonia Elijah at COVID and cancer, and how the COVID jabs could have been causing cancer potentially, We'll be looking at those fighting the net zero agenda, and also specifically after the break at Zionism, that is to do with possible armed intervention to stop the Israelis in Gaza. Also, David Livingstone's just got a new book out about Zionism, which is about the Jewish heresy. We'll be hearing also an amazing clip from LBC where some Zionist phones up and gets really amazingly well put down by James O'Brien. And also this week, a special investigation again into Martin Bormann. Guess what? More evidence that the British intelligence were involved with him. Because guess where his private secretary ended up? Remember, he was Rudolf Hess's private secretary, and we've got a bit about Hess too. But his private secretary was named as Elsa Kruger. Well, guess what? She married a British intelligence officer, and they settled up near Liverpool after the war and then moved to Cambridge, centre of the spy recruitment services. So a load about Bormann again this week. Isn't it amazing? This just will not go away. Then we look at the ethics of abortion and this idea that you can be arrested for praying against abortion near abortion clinics. And finally, Solomon and the Mark of the Beast. So plenty to be getting on with. I really do miss having Martin to spar with on these things. So, you know, we'll hopefully be back very soon in May. But let's crack on, and we'll start with a listen to good old Lord Sumption. Well, we had him last week, and he gave a fantastic speech in 2021, I believe, possibly 2022, to a group of lawyers, and he called it COVID government by decree. And he had this to say about how Britain is basically, under COVID, had become a police state. And remember, this is a former High Court, former Supreme Court judge.
Now, there was a number of other steps radically affecting the rights of individuals, which the government took without any kind of parliamentary sanction. Most of these involved exploiting existing regulatory regimes. The 2 meter distancing rule, for example, was uncritically adopted by the Health and Safety Executive. As a result, a number of building sites and factories where it was impractical to observe it were required to close, although they were not included in the closure orders made under statutory powers. Perhaps the most remarkable example concerns the steps which the government took to deprive people of access to medical and dental services. The provision of medical and dental services was expressly excluded from the closure orders made under the Public Health Act. However, a combination of government advice and government-inspired pressure from regulators was used to limit access to general practitioners. They were required to conduct video triages and refer serious cases to hospitals while telling others to wait. This has had a serious impact on the diagnosis and early treatment of far more mortal diseases than COVID-19, notably cancer. More drastic still were the steps taken to close down dental practices. On the 25th of March, the chief dental officer, a government official, published a statement referring to the Prime Minister's announcement of the lockdown and requiring dentists to stop all non-urgent activity. In reality, they were required to stop even urgent activity as well. Their role was limited to carrying out a video triage of patients. Urgent cases were to be referred to a small number of regional urgent dental units, which essentially performed extractions. Treatment was to be refused in all other cases. This direction, which had no statutory basis, left many people in pain or discomfort for months and threatened a significant number of dental practices with insolvency. Even after it was lifted at the beginning of June, distancing rules were imposed, which seriously reduced the number of patients that a dentist could see and made dental practices, in many cases, financially unviable. Now, this is a serious matter because the government's use of non-statutory procedures like these escapes parliamentary scrutiny. Parliament may, for example, be taken to have approved, albeit 7 weeks late, the exception in the health regulations which allowed the provision of dental services to continue. But Parliament never had the opportunity to approve the instruction of the chief dental officer to precisely the opposite effect. These events give rise to concern on a number of counts. The most draconian of the government's interventions, with the most far-reaching economic and social effects, have been imposed under an act which does not appear to authorise them. The sheer scale on which the government has sought to govern by decree, creating new criminal offences, sometimes several times a week on the mere say-so of ministers, is in constitutional terms truly breathtaking. The government has routinely made use of the exceptional procedure, authorising it in urgent cases to dispense with advance parliamentary approval, even where the measure in question has been mooted for days or weeks in advance. Thus, the original lockdown is imposed without any kind of parliamentary scrutiny until the middle of May, 7 weeks later. Thereafter, there was little scope for further scrutiny. Even the powers which the government purported to exercise were gratuitously enlarged by tendentious and misleading guidance generally announced at press conferences. A special word needs to be said about the remarkable powers of enforcement conferred upon the police. The police received powers to enforce the lockdown regulations by giving directions to citizens which it was a criminal offence to disobey. Fixed penalty notices are normally authorised by statute in modest amounts for minor regulatory infractions, parking and lesser offences. The government's regulations, however, authorised them for a great variety of newly created offences and sometimes in very large amounts. On the 26th of August, the government introduced by decree an offence of being involved in a gathering exceeding 30 people, and it empowered any policeman in the land to issue a fixed penalty notice of £10,000. This sum, enough to ruin most people, was far in excess of any fine that would be imposed by a court for such an offence. The power was originally advertised as being intended to deal with raves, but it has of course been used for much wider purposes. In particular, it has been used to suppress protests against the government's coronavirus policies. On the 30th of August, the police served a £10,000 fixed penalty notice on Mr. Piers Corbyn for addressing a rally against masks in Trafalgar Square. The regulations contain an exception for political protest, provided that the organisers have agreed a risk assessment and taken reasonable steps to ensure safety. On the 26th of September, the police broke up a demonstration against the government's measures, whose organisers had agreed a risk assessment with the local authority and had taken reasonable steps to ensure safety. The police claimed to have done this because some of the demonstrators had not acted in accordance with the arrangements made by the organisers. So they cleared the square using batons with considerable violence, injuring about 20 people who were guilty of nothing other than attending an apparently lawful protest. There is, of course, a notable piece of selection involved in these actions. No such fines, arrests or assaults have been seen in other demonstrations, such as those organised by Black Lives Matter or Extinction Rebellion, which did not observe social distancing either, but were thought by the police to have greater public support. The Mayor of London applauded the police action on the 26th of September. The silence from civil rights organisations such as Liberty has been deafening. The police's powers of summary arrest are regulated by primary legislation, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984. Under Regulation 9.7 of the original lockdown regulations, the government purported to amend that act by enlarging the police's powers of arrest so that they extended to any case in which a policeman reasonably believed that it was necessary to arrest a citizen in order to maintain public health. I need hardly say that the Public Health Act confers no power on ministers to amend other primary legislation in this way. In fact, the police substantially exceeded even the vast powers that they received. In the period immediately after the announcement of the lockdown, a number of chief constables announced that they would stop people acting in a way that they regarded as inessential, although there was no warrant for this in the regulations. One of them threatened to go through the shopping baskets of those exercising their right to obtain supplies so as to ensure that they were not buying anything that a constable might regard as inessential. Other forces set up roadblocks to enforce powers that they did not possess. Derbyshire police notoriously sent up surveillance drones and published on the internet a film clip denouncing people taking exercise in the Derbyshire Fells, something which people were absolutely entitled to do. When I ventured to criticise them in a BBC interview for acting beyond their powers, I received a letter from the Derbyshire Police Commissioner objecting to my remarks on the ground that in a crisis such things were necessary. The implication was that in a crisis the police were entitled to do whatever they thought fit without being unduly concerned about the limits of their legal powers. That is my definition of a police state.
So that's Lord Sumption there. Yes, police state. And isn't it interesting to hear the various tactics and methods by which they kind of spatchcocked in this whole idea of lockdowns? I've been reading Kees van der Peil's book, States of Emergency, recently, where he explains very clearly that this whole pandemic had been being cooked up for years by the pharmaceutical industry, and particularly by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the various things that they fund, as well as the Wellcome Trust, which is based here in the UK. They're two kind of sides of the same coin, each side of the Atlantic, really, those two. But excellent description there by Lord Sumption of the actually the illegality, really. The criminality, potentially, as well. If the Crown Prosecution Service, King Charles, wanted to prosecute anybody, that would be no problem. But funnily enough, he doesn't. So when it comes to Piers Corbyn getting a mention in there for this £10,000 fine, I asked him about this, and I spoke to Piers Corbyn this week about his attempt to stand to be London Mayor in 2024 against Sadiq Khan. He's been having a few hiccups.
I'm Piers Corbyn, and I'm attempting to stand as a mayor candidate. And to stand, they have two hurdles. One is you have to get an adequate number of signatures with the numbers on the electoral roll shown. Although there have been people disputing that they have to show those numbers, but that's another story. Second thing is you have to put down a deposit, which is returnable if you get more than 5% of the votes. And that deposit has to be put down at the same time as by the nomination deadline. Well, my case, I got the signatures. Although I didn't have a deposit in there, a person who got knocked out because they didn't have the signatures transferred their deposit to me. Election Authority don't dispute that that has happened, but they say that it didn't happen before the deadline. However, there's nothing in there which says it has to. It's the only law is that the deposit has to be in there before the deadline, which it was. And that money became mine and certainly wasn't anybody else's. That's my issue. There's another guy who's also been removed who didn't have the nomination signatures with electoral numbers. And he says that the electoral numbers are not required if you look at the law properly. Anyway, that's another case. But the point is that we are planning to seek a judicial review of the whole election process. And either be let in or the process declared, incorrect.
British elections, Piers, British elections are becoming increasingly bogged down by bureaucracy.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of people being...
Particularly with the voter registration, the voter ID. Just give us an idea of what platform you're standing on, please.
Yeah, platform I'm standing on is peace. Peace now. The reason being, because the killings going on in Palestine, and of course there's the wars in fighting in Ukraine, and there's bombing in the Yemen, and there's military exercises in Finland, and British and Russian troops are fighting each other right now in Ukraine. So we're standing on peace now as the prime issue, but there's plenty of other things as well, such as we want to end all the ULEZ, ultra low emission zone nonsense, and close down all the cameras. So those are the two basic things that we're standing on. But the point about the peace now is that the government and the media want to have a kind of election on Muslims sort of versus the rest, or are Muslims being maltreated or not, that sort of stuff, to create division and therefore rally people around Sadiq Khan, for example, because Muslims have been discriminated against or something, right? Well, I point out to people, a lot of people who are ethnic minorities think they should vote for Sadiq Khan because he's them or something. And I say, well, look here, this Sadiq Khan is working with Keir Starmer and the government to kill people as we speak in Palestine. So, you know, this is a nonsense.
Yeah, but hang on. Khan has come out for a ceasefire, hasn't he, in Gaza?
Well, yeah, but what's he been doing? I mean, you know, he's only come out for a ceasefire as fashion when he's, you know, what's he doing against London companies which are exporting arms, for example? You know, nothing at all. So,
the long and short of it is that you haven't got your money in on time, you can't stand.
Well, we did get money in on time. And we've got a long legal letter that's come back from them, which is, we're going through it. Because we had said before, UK, we won't have a judicial review if you let us back in and explain why, you know, in detail. And they've written a long letter back, which probably has got holes in. So we're going through that now to see what we can do in the High Court tomorrow. No, money was in there, allocated to us in advance of the deadline.
One of the other issues is back in the lockdown, you were fined £10,000, weren't you? Whatever happened to that?
Well, that particular fine, they dropped it and merged it into the court case of the five main organisers for protests in the 2020, which I was one of them. And that then became a smaller fine, which is gone with a bundle of fines, which I'm paying at the rate of £5 a week.
How long is that for, if you're going to have to pay off the £10,000?
Well, quite a time. But they reduced that one from £10,000 to a lot less. I think it ended up as £300.
Social media-wise, where do people follow you?
I have a Telegram group, Peace Now London, is one. The other one is where most of my followers are, in fact, is on Piers_Corbyn_StopNewNormal. And that has got 1,000 of followers.
Well, best of luck standing against Khan. Piers Corbyn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. All the best.
So there's the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn's brother, Piers Corbyn, a rather different character, a little bit more on the radical end, the direct action end, the street protesting end. Piers Corbyn there talking about his bid to be London mayor in 2024, next month, and some of the problems he's had getting together the cash to put in as a deposit. But anyway, some people that are having no problem making money, and of course this is why people like Piers are standing, are these monopolists. A few months ago we had the Shell and the BP results, but particularly Shell. So this is oil, is incredibly profitable because now the market has been dominated, monopolised or duopolised or oligopolised. They can charge what they want for fuel, can't they? You know, all the petrol stations go up at the same time. And even if you look at the Al Jazeera, they quite often on there, they'll have the prices. Oh, look, oil prices going down. But hang on, it's been going up at the pumps. That's funny. But this is called price fixing. This is fascism. This is oligarchy. This is where you don't have any say at all. So it's not a democracy where companies like Tesco's have an enormous leap in their profits of over 10% in 1 year because they're able to price fix, because they're working in concert with the other private equity owned supermarkets. So anyway, here's a BBC News report this week about Tesco's.
Supermarket giant Tesco has revealed it made a profit of £2.76 billion last year. Nina has been looking at those numbers for us. Morning.
Thanks, John. Yeah, Tesco had already been feeling confident, with the chief exec recently saying they'd started the year off with a bang, and that is reflected in these preliminary annual results. So profits last year, as John was saying, of £2.76 billion. They'll be pleased with that. It's slightly higher than the predicted results they'd already revised upwards. What that represents is an 11% increase in profit and a 4.4% increase in annual sales. Tesco, of course, the supermarket giant. 4,500 stores, a 27% market share. That's way higher than Sainsbury's at 15%. So how's it managed to build on growth during these hard times for consumers? Well, firstly, they've worked smart by competing with Aldi and Lidl, by matching their prices on thousands of products, and by broadening their home brand range. But here's the good news. They also say that inflation on groceries has, quote, lessened substantially. So that means those price increases have slowed for them and therefore for us too. You might even have seen some prices coming down. Sliced white bread, cakes, for example. It's reasonable to feel some relief at these price rises slowing, but vital to remember it's a slowdown rather than a reduction in prices. Your overall big shop won't be getting cheaper anytime soon, if ever. John.
Okay, Nina, thank you for that.
So £2.76 billion in profit. Not, this is not turnover, this is profit, folks. They made last year at Tesco's. So who is it that's actually buying up a lot of these shares in these massive oligopolies? It's private equity. And the other aspect of this which is being affected is further down the food chain. In other words, the farmers. So let's have a listen now to Mark Byford explaining how private equity firms are affecting farming. I mean, he's himself a farmer, so he knows what he's talking about. And he's explaining the pressures that there are on farmers, because the big companies, the big corporations, are not just doing it to us in the supermarkets. They're doing exactly the same right across the country to farmers.
Is there anyone in here who has 3 meals a day? Yeah? Fair show of hands. 3 meals a day, yeah? Fair? 365 days in a year. So it's 1,000 plates, you can say, of food for each person in your house. And when I say to people, have you got food supply stored up for how long? And you work it out platefuls, and then you go, well, it's for us in our house, it's free. That's 3,000 plates. That's a lot of food if you're trying to get it all together now, all right? So where does that end up? Because at the end of the day, we're in a position now where food prices have gone up exponentially. We all know that in the last couple of years, food prices have gone through the roof. Why? And I just want to show you something. How much was the cauliflower?
75.
Right, £1.75. Do you know how much the farmer was paid for that? So that's what you as a customer walking in the door, you're going to Sainsbury's, that's going to cost you £1.75. Do you know how much the farmer got paid for that?
Okay.
Now, there's two systems. I don't know, for those who know, who deal with supermarkets, there's two systems. Some, where the farmer only does bed and breakfast for the crop. The crop belongs to Tesco's or Sainsbury's, wherever it might be, and they pay them like a penny a cauliflower to grow it. Everyone what leaves the farm. Or they buy that off of them at 28 pence. Now, you do the maths. You know what you're paying as a consumer, and the farmers are getting completely screwed the other end. Who's earning all the money? And here's the big kicker. We all support them. What percentage of people do, unfortunately? I don't. £1.20. Litre of milk, £1.20. This is at Sainsbury's today, on the way down. £1.20. How much do you reckon the farmer gets? I did a report on this the other day. I was on the Richard Vogue show talking about this. So, cost of production of that is 42p, right? That's what the farmers reckon it costs the producer. Farmer gets 32p for taking it off the farm. So they lose 10 pence a litre, every litre what goes in the tanker, that goes up the drive to go to a supermarket, they're losing money. Then anyone will go, well, why the hell did they sign the contract? The problem is, when they signed that contract 2-3 years ago, costs are running the farmers down here. During the pandemic, fair to say, red diesel was, what, 20 pence a litre then? Now it's going up 90 pence a pound a litre some places. So cost of running the farm has gone through the frickin' roof. Cost of electric to run the, whether that's heating the sheds or for the animals, or whether that's running the corn dryers, whatever any farmer's got to do, there is always this challenge that the costs have got exponential. Like I said earlier, feed prices. When I took my farm on at Thurston, the grain for the chickens then was £4, I think then £4.90 a bag. Just shy of a fiver. Now, that's like £12.90 a bag. Depends on what ones you buy, obviously. But that's how much it's gone up. So the cost of running the farm has just got absolutely out of control. In the background of that as well, you've also got the other side that a lot of the farmers are being encouraged, I will say, not forced, encouraged.
Coerced,
whatever word you want to use, to not farm. And we'll cover this in the second half. One of the things of the three things we're going to cover in the second half is legislation. And the legislation now that farmers go through because of DEFRA and the Environment Agency is mind-blowing. Just mind-blowing. The legislation that wasn't there, the farming side's got really bad. So legislation is a big issue. So as a result of the legislation increase, farmers have got to the point they don't want to farm. Because it's not about farming anymore. It's about this massive amount of paperwork they've got to deal with. Now, we have to have a certificate to say it's gone to the correct place. Mm-hmm. So if you lose a pig, so it's not going to market anymore, you're not getting paid for it, so you're down, let's say, £90, £80, £90, whatever the pig's worth. Oh no, now you've got to pay up to £100 to get it collected, right? So you've lost your pig and you've lost your £100. And it's just those little things what just got to the point where I was like, running the farm going, and I was only a small farm, 12 acres. Some of these people are running big sites with lots of production and massive overheads. It just gets worse and worse. I feel for anyone who's in the farming side. As a result of all that, there's various under the green schemes, which we'll cover a bit more on later. There's lots of options for farmers to get out of farming, right? So they'll come along, the government will make sure that the right person turns up. So you've got the option to farmer to sell up if you don't want to continue. And what one of the biggest challenges has been is that a lot of people my age, dads and uncles and so forth, had the farms. They didn't want us to go into farming because they've dealt with all this shit they've had to deal with. As a result of that, where do you end up? So you lost a generation. Lots of the farms I go to buy veg and stuff from, it's the grandkids who are wanting to take over the farms because they're understanding where the farmer's got to go to. So you've got this transition period, and Rachel and I have been working with Catherine McBean from the People's Food and Farming Alliance, put together a video over the last few weeks which has gone out to talk about the transition in farming. So as a result of lots of the farmers getting out, and there's over 2,000 farms, so bear in mind there's 105,000 farms in the UK, over 2,000 in the past few months have already taken the money to get out of farming. So they get given a handout and they sell the farm. Okay? You've got all 2,000 farms been wiped out. You do the research. Don't take any notice of me. Do the research and you find out who's bought all them farms. I guarantee you two names will come to roost. I guarantee it. One's BlackRock. Vanguard, every time. Right?
Vanguard.
They always say, follow the money. Yeah, they obviously follow the science. We know that worked out for us. But if you follow the money, it ends up with those two companies every time, all buying up all the land.
So that was farmer Mark Byford speaking in Needham Market, a farming talk that he gave recently, and explaining some of the problems that the farmers are suffering with, and particularly the intervention of these massive private equity firms. Private equity, we're staying with that because BlackRock and Vanguard, I'm sure many of you actually have got a permanent link up to that brilliant film from a couple of years ago by the Dutch woman on the power of BlackRock and Vanguard and how they've managed to buy up virtually everything in the world. Anyway, so the plan is apparently to privatise everything. The Price is Wrong is a book by Brett Christophers just out. And here he is being interviewed by Aaron Bastani. So he's really saying, yes, the plan is to privatise everything. And I rather like the title of this book, The Price is Wrong.
Broadly speaking, until the 1980s, all of the money that asset managers invested got invested in financial assets, as you say, bonds and equities of different kinds. It was in the 80s they started to invest in real assets. In the beginning, that was essentially called commercial property. So, you know, office blocks, shopping centres, hotel chains, that sort of thing. And then from the 90s onwards, you added two new types of, as you say, quote unquote, real assets to that. So the first was residential property. So housing in different forms, whether that's, you know, apartment blocks, single family housing, student housing, care homes, even mobile home communities in the US. And the other one was infrastructure of various types, which can be energy infrastructure is probably the main one. So infrastructures of energy generation, transmission, distribution, transportation infrastructures, roads, bridges, tunnels, parking systems, telecommunications infrastructure, and also social infrastructure, things like hospitals, schools, prisons, and so on. And I guess the main argument, one of the main arguments I try to make in the book is that, you know, when asset managers just invested in financial assets, what they did was actually pretty far removed from our daily lives, the daily lives of most individuals. But once asset managers are owning and controlling the houses in which we live, the roads on which we, you know, drive to work or pay tolls, the hospitals in which we're being treated, the schools in which our children are going to school and so on, then they potentially have a far more significant and far more direct impact on the daily lives of, you know, large numbers of people than they did back in the day. And, you know, one of the examples I cite in the book is the Australian asset management firm Macquarie, which I think by almost any measure is the biggest asset manager in the world in terms of investment in infrastructure. And on its website, it estimates that around 100 million people around the world use infrastructures every day that it owns. So it has a huge, insofar as it determines the conditions in which those infrastructures exist. It determines the fees that we pay to access and use those infrastructures. It has a huge impact on people's daily lives. And 99.9% of those 100 million people would have no idea that those infrastructures that they are using and relying on every day are owned by this kind of abstruse financial institution headquartered in Sydney. The simple reason why they're so important today, forget about kind of what it is they're buying, what they're investing in, is that they have so much capital at their disposal, right? If you look in recent decades at the amount of surplus capital in the world available for investment, whether that's held by pension funds, whether that's held by sovereign wealth funds, has increased dramatically. And at the same time, the proportion of that surplus capital that is invested via asset managers rather than directly has also increased dramatically. And so today, asset managers control over $100 trillion of capital for investment, whereas in the 1970s, it was considerably less than $1 trillion. So it's been one of the most significant changes in the modern history of contemporary capitalism.
$100 trillion, just for, you know, context, what the UK economy is about, $2.3 trillion. The global economy is 100 trillion or less.
I think it might even be less.
Yeah. In my head, I think 80 trillion, but that's probably because I read, like, you know, The Economist 7 years ago or something. Things move on.
Yeah. But it's a lot of money.
Yeah. Broadly equivalent to global GDP. You said that there's been a big change here. So again, people my age were getting on a bit, who were politicized by the financial crisis. We obviously look at the bad guys as the banks.
Yeah.
You've got to tax the banks.
Yeah.
One of the insights here is actually a huge amount of power has gone from banks that we might recognize who aren't just obviously operating on the high street like HSBC or Citibank or whatever. A lot of that power and a lot of the things that they're responsible for are going to asset managers. Can you just explain how that's worked?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And there's lots of different dimensions to it. I think the first thing to say is just as one kind of very sort of, in a way trivial, but also I think quite telling measure of that shifting influence. You know, when I was younger and, you know, people would talk about the influence of the financial sector on political parties in the US, UK and so on, you would always think of, you know, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan and so on as having kind of the ear of government, as being those that were kind of shaping government policy in one way or another. That's just not really true anymore. So whenever we hear these days about financial sector lobbying and governments around the world coming under the influence of the financial sector, it's almost invariably Blackstone, BlackRock, KKR and others like that. So that's just one measure of that shifting influence. And the financial crisis definitely hastened that. And I think one of the reasons for that, probably the biggest reason for that, was that, you know, while a lot of us on the left like to think, well, you know, the financial crisis didn't change anything. Well, it did change a lot of things. And one of the things it changed is that the banks did come under much more significant regulation, not least in the US through Dodd-Frank after the financial crisis. And they were...
Which was a piece of legislation.
A piece of financial regulation. And they were sort of increasingly constrained in what they could and could do. And asset managers escaped that. And I think in particular, the type of asset manager that I talk about in the book, and we can talk about their specificity in due course, escaped that. And so while the banks kind of got hobbled a little bit, asset managers and what our people will often refer to as shadow banks more generally sort of continued on their merry way. And that's just continued to be the case ever since. And so I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, and again, one of the measures of that is that one of the things that the Goldmans of this world have tried to do in the last decade is precisely to pump up their own asset management divisions to try to keep pace with the BlackRocks and the Vanguards and the Blackstones of this world.
Author of The Price is Wrong, Brett Christopher's there, doing, I think, a superb job in just picking apart the way that these private equity firms, I think he also kind of touched on there what we were hearing last week, which is from Kees van der Peil, that the 2008 financial crisis was a massive change in regulation. And it meant that the hedge funds sort of dissolved and became private equity companies. Because there was a new model they set up, and these were aiming to control our infrastructure, which of course they're doing, privatising everything. So if we let them carry on doing this, well, we will just have like IG Farben and Krupps, that is to say the big German conglomerates that during the 1930s controlling and running everything, as happened with Standard Oil in the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s. They just began buying up everything, absolutely everything, because they had such powerful lobbying power with government that they could do what they want, just as Goldman Sachs have very powerful lobbying power with a certain Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, who's going to lose the general election. That's what he's there for, to hand everything over to good old Keir Starmer. So anyway, our next piece is looking at the other side, I suppose, which is the way that King Charles, who seems to be absolutely in with all these private equity companies, has totally neglected the charities that the royals are supposed to patronise. Now, of course, he's got fantastic amounts of money, and when they just refuse or forget or neglect to appoint a patron to a charity, that means that none of this royal money that the Queen used to give to these charities is going there anymore. Very, very significant. And he's made an incredibly important political move by defunding hundreds of charities in Britain, which people haven't really heard much about. This was popped up in the Daily Express a couple of weeks ago. But let's not forget what Charlie's up to. He's destroying the charitable sector.
Hundreds of charities are still without a royal patron following the deaths of Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip. Buckingham Palace says it's reviewing the system under King Charles.
Llandaff Cathedral in Cardiff has a connection so close with monarchs, it's carved into the building.
What are we seeing over here?
Well, we're on the north side of the cathedral now, outside. And if you look up there high, there's a stone carving of Queen Elizabeth II, our late patron. To her left is King George VI, her father, who was patron before her.
The late Queen was royal patron of the Friends of the Cathedral, and it meant a lot.
We support the heritage, the music and the fabric of the cathedral. And I think people look at what we do. And then if your leaflet also says patron, Her Majesty the Queen, that adds something to it as well. It must do.
The King attended a remembrance service here for the late Queen. The Friends hope he'll take over her role, but they're waiting to hear. They're also waiting at the Dogs Trust, another of the late Queen's 600 royal patronages.
The palace contacted us a little while after the funeral and let us know that they were reviewing. They did say it was going to take a while and asked us all to be patient, which is absolutely what we're doing. We know there's lots of changes that need to happen in place. We haven't heard anything recently, but we're hopeful that we will hear something soon.
There are 3,000 royal patronages, but hundreds are vacant, following the deaths of the Queen and Prince Philip. The difficult departures of Andrew and Harry also left gaps. Buckingham Palace is reviewing patronages, including those of the King and Queen. But do these positions of public life really matter? Some think so.
I refer to it as the patronage bargain. So on the one hand, you have the patron, and on the other hand, you have the charitable organisation. And there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between the two organisations. It's not just about the charity itself benefiting. There's also a reflected glow that perhaps the patron also receives.
Others question the purpose of patronage, once the bread and butter of the British monarchy.
It's impossible to work out the exact value of a royal patronage, but charities say it brings kudos and credibility, which is why they're all desperate to find out what happens next.
People have long spoken of a streamlined monarchy, but this slimmed-down lineup comes with a cost, and there simply aren't enough working royals to fill vacant roles. Laura Bundock, Sky News.
So hundreds of charities are still without a royal patron. That means nobody is giving them any money from the royal purse, which is enormous. And of course, Charles did inherit all that without paying a single penny in tax on it from his mum. The billions that they've got and the crown estates, etc. So that's, I suppose, the other side of the coin. As private equity buys all these things up, the charities are being closed down, and of course the private equity firms can snap up all that charitable land, all those charitable assets, for next to nothing. Anyway, a bit of a gear shift now onto COVID, and it's becoming increasingly clear that the mRNA COVID jabs, by the way, Sinovax, it's the one from China, is not an mRNA jab, but all the other types are. They, rather than producing the poison, if you want to call it that, antigen in a laboratory and putting it into you and you getting some sort of immunity like that. The whole point of these mRNAs is they produce this antigen inside your body. Well, is that a good idea? Well, it doesn't look like it is, no, because as Dr. John Campbell quoting Angus Dalgleish here points out, there are massive concerns about growing rates of cancer in young people.
There's something I want to bring to your attention, and it's an article. Again, this is fully referenced. I'm going to give it all to you. It's by Angus Dalgleish, a professor of oncology, one of the most senior physicians in the country, actually. And he's written this article: mRNA vaccines must be banned once and for all, in the opinion of Professor Dalgleish. Now, let's see what his rationale for this is and see if it makes sense. Now, he says this, and we reported on this in some detail at the time and recorded a video with Professor Dalgleish on this. At the end of last year, I reported I was seeing melanoma patients, that's the skin cancer, but of course it spreads all over the body. Melanoma can kill you actually really quickly. I've seen patients die of melanoma in months, not years. But Professor Dalgleish has been keeping his patients alive for 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years, I believe. Quite remarkable success in oncology. So at the end of last year, Professor Dalgleish said he was seeing more melanoma reactivation, seeing melanoma patients who have been stable for years relapse after their first booster. That's the third injection. And he also says in this article, which I'm going to give you the reference for, the number of my patients affected has been rising ever since. So stable melanoma patients, cancers reactivated after the booster. Now, if Professor Dowgli says this, this should be taken seriously. And all we need to say there's no problem here is for the regulatory authorities to stand up and say, Professor Dowgli is wrong, there is no reactivation of melanoma after booster doses of vaccine. Clear the decks, then we'd know where we stand. So far, I haven't heard them say that. So other oncologists have contacted me from all around the world, including Australia and the United States. So being one of the leading oncologists in the world, Professor Dowgli obviously has international networks and is being contacted by colleagues from Australia and the United States. And after booster doses, these colleagues are reporting more lymphomas. Now, lymphoma is a potentially deadly cancer of the lymphatic system. You've probably heard of Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So more lymphomas being reported to Professor Dowglish, more leukemias being reported to Professor Dowglish, a group of cancers that affect the blood. More kidney cancers are being reported as well. And then Professor Dowglish says this, my colorectal cancer colleagues reporting an epidemic of explosive cancers. Explosive cancers doesn't sound good. Those presenting with multiple metastatic spread, the liver and elsewhere. So what very often happens is a cancer will begin in the colon and then it then spreads to the liver. And of course, ideally, we'd pick it up when it's still just in the colon and be able to resect it, get rid of it, treat it, hopefully just with endoscopy. But if it's already spread to the liver, the prognosis is very gloomy indeed. And if Professor Dowglish is saying this, again, all it needs is the regulatory authority to stand up and say, you know what, we've looked at this, there is no increase in lymphoma, there is no increase in leukemia, there is no increase in kidney cancer, there is no increase in colorectal cancer, and if there is, it's certainly not attributable to COVID vaccines. Just stand up, say that, be clear. It's not. I mean, if it was me saying this, then of course they could reasonably ignore me. But this is not me saying this, is one of the world's leading oncologists saying this. And it's a question that should be answered. If there's no problem here, say there's no problem, clear it up, we'll all go home and we'll start thinking about infectious diseases and other problems around the world, of which there are many. So there we are, reactivations of melanoma, potential lymphomas, leukemias, kidney cancer, colorectal cancers, often presenting at a late stage. Please, regulatory authorities, dismiss this, say it's rubbish, and reduce my anxiety levels.
So that's Dr. John Campbell there. He's Global Cancer Concerns, video and excerpt from that. Longer version, I hope, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Certainly a link to the video at thisweek.org.uk. But we go on to much deeper depth now with Sonia Elijah, one of my colleagues from Holding the Line Journalist Group during the COVID pandemic. And she's been doing her own inquiry and her own report on this explosion of cancer in young people and potential links to the mRNA vaccines.
Today we're going to jump into your research about your latest stories that you've written. It's entitled The Princess of Wales is Truly Not Alone in Her Cancer Treatment. And this is something a lot of us are hearing about cancers and turbo cancers especially, that cancers aren't as rare as they used to be in the old days. Is this really something to do with these injections?
Oh, I believe it is, because so this report that I wrote, so on March 22nd, that's when the Princess of Wales announced that she was in the early stages of cancer treatments. Like, very sad news. She's a young woman, a young mum. And so she wrote that she sort of signed off. Her last thing she said was, you are not alone. And I thought, well, you know, that's I can pick up on that, because truly she is not alone. We are not alone, because so many young people are facing cancer now these days. And it's not just in the UK. It's in many other countries too. And so what I did was I looked at two scientific papers, because everything I write on, Alistair, is always backed up by evidence. I would never write on conjecture or my opinion, because I don't have to, right? The evidence speaks for itself. So I looked at two papers. One was focusing on the US data. So this is data sourced from the US CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we have the researchers. This is the study done by Alegria et al. And there were three researchers. I interviewed one of them, Dr. David Wiseman, and they looked at US death trends for neoplasms for the ages 15 to 44. And they delved into the cancer-related mortality from 2010 up to 2022. And they found an alarming pattern. So they saw a sizable uptick in cancer as the primary cause of death, and also its occurrence as a contributing factor to mortality across multiple cases. But what they found is that the increase in excess mortality in both 2021 and 2022, this is from neoplasms, from cancers, are highly statistically significant. And they classified it as extreme events. And they go on to write, so this I'm just quoting from the paper, which is in my report. The results indicate that from 2021, a novel phenomenon leading to increased neoplasm deaths appears to be present in individuals aged 15 to 44 in the US. And that wasn't just it. So we have that paper focusing on the US. Now, earlier in this is early 2024, another paper came out, and two of the authors actually, same authors, two of the authors are the same. They investigated cancer rates in the UK, and in individuals aged 15 to 44. And for the UK, it showed much larger deviations from trend in 2021 and 2022. And the authors write, we show a large increase in morbidities, like these are disabilities, and mortality due to malignant neoplasms that started in 2021 and accelerated substantially in 2022. And they ended it the same. They wrote, the results indicate that from late 2021, a novel phenomenon leading to increased malignant neoplasm deaths and disabilities appears to be present in individuals aged 15 to 44 in the UK. So we have these two, I would say, cornerstone. You know, these are sort of the cornerstone here, because you have them analysing the data, seeing the trend, seeing the statistically significant uptick, 2021 and 2022. And all I do is ask the question, what was the novel phenomenon? What was introduced at that time? What was going on? It was the vaccine. It was the gene therapy-based product that rollout.
Sonia Elijah there, speaking on the Inquiry Session podcast, Reality Check Radio with Alistair Harding. Absolutely amazing. The turbo cancer worldwide, these young people getting cancer. So she's looking at that pretty closely. Good old Sonia Elijah. And the concerns, of course, from that are that there really is no proper regulation. One of the reasons for that is people like David Cameron, our now Foreign Secretary, and Nick Clegg destroyed the all the people who were doing the regulations years ago, in the 2010, 2012, that sort of thing, that sort of time, around about then. So that's why we've got no proper regulation anymore. And these companies can do what they want, can't they? Pretty much. So we're going to have a look now at a bit more at the whole net zero agenda and this whole idea of, I mean, just amazing hearing today on the news. Oh, this is actually, I think it was an advert saying that nuclear power is net zero. Well, no, it isn't. Sorry. It's extremely, extremely damaging to the environment. It's far worse than using a diesel petrol car. You've got this horrific toxic waste. But not only that, there's billions and billions and billions of scam contract fraud money going into building these nuclear power stations, and the design that they're building when they switched it on in China, the Taishan one, after less than 6 months it conked out, and we have had no news about whether it's managed to restart or not. So this is a disastrous design, and it's just designed to make money for the people building it. Also, the price of the electricity coming out of these things is absolutely through the roof. And what they're doing, of course, is they're using using that to as a benchmark. And so the massive profits are being made from solar and wind power, which is upped to the price of nuclear power for everybody. And everyone is basically subjected to a massive energy scam as a result of all of that. So on the subject of the net zero agenda, I thought it'd be interesting to chat with somebody who here in Bristol who has, his name's Jeff Mason, who's a musician. And because of the so-called clean air zone, well, it's nothing to do with clean air, really. It's all about tolls to keep the local council afloat so that they can continue to pay the bills because central government's pulling the funding from them. And anyway, a lot of what they spend their money on is complete waste, including all these people from Sustrans and the cycling charities who are now managing our 15-minute cities and livable neighbourhoods. So let's have a listen now to Jeff Mason, the musician, who's having a pretty terrible time because of this clean air zone, bearing in mind that, you know, when he goes to a gig, he's there in one day and he's also leaving, say, at 12:30. He's got to pay for the next day too. So that's 18 quid, which just makes it not worth his while, as he explains.
I'm Jeff Mason. I'm a musician, mainly just interested in playing music, riding motorcycles. That's about it, really. But when I think COVID came along, that's when I started sort of questioning the narrative and thinking there's something not right. And the way it started rolling out, and there was a lot of info that was coming out from China, and I just thought this is rolling on too fast here, and I just questioned the whole thing. You know, it just didn't seem right to me. You know, especially the lockdowns. And why would you want to lock down an economy? You know.
Well, I think the idea is, of course, that you'll stop the disease spreading. So you're going to have to put the economy on the back burner for a while.
Yeah, it's true. Very true. But there was other aspects with the to eat out. And as it went on and further on, and you could wear your mask, you can go in the pub, but you can then take your mask off to eat. That's when it started, you know, sort of, you know, I started questioning it. Things weren't adding up.
Okay, so when you started questioning, what answers did you come up with?
I got involved in certain groups on social media, and we started putting our heads together and just sharing information, and just thought there's something not right, you know, with the whole thing. So,
In 2022 here in Bristol, we had a new clean air zone introduced at the end of the year. Which was a bizarre thing because it wasn't like most of these things, like the London congestion charge or clean air zone there, the ULEZ, which has got an obvious way around it. Here, the zone itself was like the ring road round the city centre. So in order to avoid the zone, you have to kind of go around little rat runs, little roads around the edges of the main road. So there was no obvious way round. What have you made of the implementation of that, and how has it affected you and the work you do?
Well, as a musician, it's impacted me as well as other small businesses, I would imagine, quite a great deal. I've got a non-compliant van, so obviously I'd have to pay the CAZ charge every time we're entering into the city of Bristol. A lot of our work was coming in within the city, and so it fell in within the zone. The thing is, most musicians won't leave the venue till gone midnight, and then you're into another charging area. So that's £18. And, you know, when you take into consideration the high fuel charges, and we have to buy equipment and the rest of it, it doesn't really, you're virtually just about breaking even, and sometimes you're at a loss.
What about other musicians that you're working with and speaking to?
Yeah, they're the same. There's three musicians that I work with at the moment that they've got non-compliant vehicles. So it's going to make life difficult, really. I've talked to other solo musicians, and they said they're just going to give up playing in the city of Bristol.
This is, it's only about, they're saying, it's only £9, but you're saying you reckon it's double that.
Well, it's going to be, because most musicians won't leave the venue till gone midnight, and it's then gone into another charging zone.
So have you actually had to cancel gigs so far, or are you still being managed?
No, we haven't cancelled any, but we've just won't accept any. Not in the city at the moment, no.
Well, that's Bristol musician Jeff Mason there speaking to me a couple of weeks ago about the effect that the so-called Clean Air Zone has had on him. The other thing to mention is there's a brilliant piece on Facebook I saw this week from a local homeless charity saying they're going to have to shut down. They can't afford to pay these thousands of pounds a year in the Clean Air Zone toll to bring food in for the homeless people in the city. The council don't even reply to their letters. They're not interested. So this is just a tax on good charities and poor people. This is just the sort of thing that the private equity firms and the elite, the banksters and their friends in Bristol City Council just rub their hands and they look at this and they say, great, you know, look at that. It's another charity dead. That means that more and more people will be destitute and suffering. And that's what they like. They actually like to see that because that means that those people are kind of forced into some kind of slave labour for next to no money, which hardly even if it does pay the bills. So that's that whole situation. But over in Cambridge, there's a bit of a brighter organisation. Well, I'm not sure what the organisation's called, but Ian Black, there's a longer interview with him, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I recorded a couple of weeks ago with Ian. It's how they beat the Clean Air Zone and the congestion charge. They got very well organised and bang, they did it.
We use local rags to be able to start to take votes. 91% of people who voted didn't want the thing. We start to use freedom of information requests, discover all sorts of interesting things going on in the council, which they've decided not to release to the public, that FOIs are really quite effective at being able to get. We started to create a brand and a look that people would identify with and very simple messaging that said, what is it that we're going to do? And of course, what we started to do immediately was then organise some sort of a very public event in the form of what you're looking at here, a march that, you know, got up to about 6,000 people and started to create headlines that spread the message. And here's a key point. Because the consultation only got to less than a couple of percent of the population they were meant to be consulting, most people had no clue what this thing was. So what you've got to get to is newsworthy events that capture attention and start to draw in people who are trying to live their lives and not have to fight some bureaucrat who's come up with some crazy idea that the general population don't want to support. And you can see some of the headlines here that we started to garner through local publications, Cambridge Live in this particular case. We also started to get to a point where support started to wobble. Now, what you discover here is that, of course, in these councils, they've been elected on the quiet because most people aren't interested in electing council members, and birds of a feather flock together. You'll discover that those birds of a feather aren't always perfectly aligned. So what your newsworthy events are starting to do is discover that there's a difference between the council members themselves. Start to exploit that. We set up a website. We started to do some social media in terms of going around and interviewing the local population who have the most fantastic examples of why the congestion charge will never work. From, you know, my mum who's 98 to a young mother who's got children to get to school. You get to the real stories of why these ideas are madness to begin with. And then you begin to question, well, who the heck would come up with them in the first place? And more importantly, why? That's exploiting the weak link. And here's the challenge. Most of us think that to be able to stop these things, we need vast numbers of people. We don't. You'll remember that little picture I showed you at the beginning of the Cambridge residents group. It was really a handful of people, 6 or 7 people, who decided to take action. And if you go through those 2 or 3, 4 steps I'm showing you now, you can really find the weak spots and start to press on them. And it's surprising how quickly things start to fall apart. In this particular case, as this headline shows, somebody who'd just been appointed to a prominent position in the council decided the heat was just too much. The objections coming from the general population grew in ferocity, in noise, were being communicated across all social media platforms and had started to be picked up nationally. And surprise, surprise, a very strong Labour area of Cambridge called King's Hedges voted in a Tory member because the Tory member supported dumping the congestion charge. So very quickly, what I'm trying to say is you don't need a lot of people. You do need some time to be able to exploit the weak, find and exploit the weak links in other people's arguments, the council's argument. And you'll quickly find people like Delaware, whose picture is here. He's a taxi driver. He's a taxi driver in Cambridge who decided he'd had enough and he would stand up in a Labour stronghold. And this is how we did it. The little leaflet overlay here, King's Hedges by-election. I got out on the doors with my colleagues in the CRG and we went knocked doors. Here's something else I learned doing that. Politicians don't know their audiences anymore. They used to when you and I grew up. No more. They're careerists. They're not really interested in the local population. They just want to be elected to hold power and spend money. And don't we know it in many other areas of life? So once we got out and knocked doors, I would typically be confronted with a Labour supporter who'd say, A, I didn't know about this. B, what do you mean there's going to be a toll at the end of my road? You mean I've got to go and spend X amount of money, £5, £10, or God forbid you own a lorry, by the way, that's £50, to just go shopping. And you get to a point in the conversation in less than 60, 90 seconds where they'd say, I can't vote Tory. And hey, I have every sympathy in the world with that particular position. I don't support any of them. But they'd say, well, I can't vote Tory. What do I do? Simple. Don't vote. Let us send a strong message to these people who think that they can just keep taxing you, that times are a-changing. And enough Labour voters in King's Hedges, a Labour stronghold, didn't vote. As a result, a Tory taxi driver got into position. I've never seen more panic break out in an elected force like a council and local MPs than when that happened. That really was us then beginning to roll at significant speed and the whole thing started to fall apart. But we didn't finish there. We'd now got enough speed to be able to get national attention. And that's effectively the stage that we're at now, where we're combining with other authorities and other groups throughout the UK who've suffered in the same way that you have and are in Bristol. And we're starting to combine forces. So we're really now, I think, at a point in history when we've learned how to take these people on and beat them at their own game. And their own game is to get into power. And the minute that you exploit that weak link, you'll find that they scatter like the cowards that many of them are.
That's Ian Black from Cambridge on how he and his colleagues beat the Clean Air Zone congestion charge. Made sure it didn't even happen over in Cambridge there. So coming up after the break, we have James O'Brien doing a fantastic job on LBC. Actually criticising and dealing with in a very fair way a guy called Trevor in Finchley who phoned up trying to justify the Israeli genocide in Gaza. We'll also hear from Craig Murray, and then we'll have a good look into Bormann and Bormann's secretary known as Else Kruger, who married a chap called Leslie James, who was a lieutenant colonel in the British intelligence. Isn't that funny? Bormann's secretary married into British intelligence and then went very, very quiet. She was told and she decided that she wasn't going to tell anybody anything. That's all after the break.
Oh,
So that was Funboy 3 back in 1982 with Guess What Title, but also a lovely, for this time of year, hymn We Plough the Fields and Scatter, you heard before that. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with no Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and no sound engineer Dave Pazanko, just me, Tony Gosling. Dave's away, and so we can't really do a live show. Martin can't be sitting with me here, and so we have to just do it like this for a few weeks, and hopefully it will be back in May. So anyway, I'm Tony Gosling, welcome back, and we're going to get cracking straight away with a brilliant clip from LBC this week. Just James O'Brien takes on the Israel defender Trevor in Finchley. And they're discussing the killing of aid workers in Gaza by the Israeli Defence Forces.
Trevor's in Finchley on a better line.
James, I agree with your initial comment that what happened yesterday was an absolute calamity. The fact that the aid organisation had given their coordinates to Israel and that they were still killed is indeed a tragedy. The larger issue is that how should it affect the war? My own view is that it shouldn't. Israel's in a particular state, a situation where they're confronted by an enemy that to request demands its elimination. They don't want a two-state solution. They want a one-state solution.
Well, Netanyahu and much of his cabinet doesn't want a two-state solution either. So does that justify their elimination from the other side of this argument?
I think you have to look at the history of...
Just answer the question, if you would.
Sorry, what was that?
Just answer. Well, you must know what the question was because you were just about to dismiss it.
And, I heard repeat the question, James.
Okay, so Benjamin Netanyahu and many members of his cabinet are on the record as opposing a two-state solution now. Does that somehow justify calls for their elimination as well?
The two things don't run together. The fact that they want
to... Yes,
they
do. You told me that the justification for the elimination of Hamas, regardless of what the collateral damage to innocent civilians might be, was built upon their refusal to accept a two-state solution.
That's completely absurd.
So that's what you said. So I'm wondering whether Benjamin Netanyahu...
And James.
I'm repeating your own words back to you.
That's not the reason there's a war. The war is not because they want a one-state solution.
No, but the need to eliminate Hamas is because they reject a two-state solution. You just told me that.
They've launched a genocidal war on Israel. That is the reason there is a war, not because they have a view that they have a one-to-one.
And you've just justified the elimination of everybody in Gaza in pursuit of Hamas.
How do you then convey the idea of wanting to demilitarize Hamas and remove them militarily?
Because you're here to justify the killing of civilians.
Who's justifying the killing of civilians?
Well,
who justifies? Where did I say that, James? Why are you inventing words?
Because you said that you want what's happening now to continue, and tens of thousands of civilians are already dead. Ergo, to call for what is happening now to continue, you're calling for the continuing killing of innocent civilians.
No.
This isn't complicated, Trevor.
They are. How many people have been killed in Gaza? 32,000?
That we know about.
So, that we know about. The United Nations number of civilians killed to combatants generally is recorded as 9 to 1. That's a UN figure. The number of civilians, the people who have been killed in total, is about 32,000. If you accept
that we know
Israel's
about.
Now, James, if you accept Israel's figures of, say, 13 to 14,000 combatants.
Why would I accept those figures?
2. That is well below.
Why would I
what
accept
the
those figures?
United Nations have as a figure.
Why would I accept those figures?
What, you'd rather accept Hamas's figures rather than United Nations figures?
You're talking about Israel's figures.
Hamas's figures are more credible than United Nations?
I think that Human Rights Watch has detailed the measures that the Palestinian Health Authority takes to record casualties and deaths with reference to mortuaries and hospitals, and explained that by publishing biographical details and names, they have a more reliable record than many other comparable conflict zones, whereas you think you should trust what the Israeli Defense Force tells us while refusing to allow foreign journalists into that territory. Just talk me through that.
Well, I'd accept the United Nations. Well, the fact that all these figures are going to have to be verified at some time later.
So why are you telling me to trust one and not? Why are you telling me to trust one and not another then, Trevor?
Because the United Nations, well, the 32,000 figure comes from Hamas. You're quite prepared to.
It comes from the Palestinian Health Authority, which the Human Rights Watch have provided objective analysis of. Who provides objective analysis of what the Israeli Defense Force tells you?
Or Hamas. So if you're going to
you can't keep doing this. I've told you what Human Rights Watch say about the measures that the Palestinian Health Authority deploy to list their death toll. Who provides objective external scrutiny of the numbers that the Israeli Defense Force provides?
Well, you either accept Israel.
You're going to have to answer the question at some point. Who provides objective international scrutiny of the numbers that you have come on the show to tell me I should trust?
I would like to suggest to you.
I'm going to ask you again until you answer the question, because we both know the answer. We both know the answer.
Who provides? We don't know the answer. No, we don't, James.
Well, I'll tell you then, Trevor. Nobody.
No, you have to, well, either you accept or not accept that Israel's figures are as close as verifiable as possible. Either you can denounce them because it's Israel.
But I've just told you that Human Rights Watch are the body to whom I turn for guidance on this matter. Who's the body to whom you turn for guidance on whether the IDF's figures are reliable?
Well, the United Nations Human Rights Watch is an organisation that has vilified Israel in the past.
Okay,
as being
so they're biased as well.
And so I would
so
also,
then we come back to this question. Why won't they allow foreign correspondents into the territory?
I've no idea. You'll have to ask them.
Well, let's think it through together, shall we? Because here we are arguing about the facts.
Why is that important to you? Why is that important to having all the having?
Well, because I believe in objective external scrutiny, and I'm intrigued as to why you think Israel rejects it at every turn.
I think there are more important issues at the moment.
Yeah, but you've rung in to talk about these issues, so you'll indulge me. You'll indulge me then, Trevor. Why would Israel refuse access to foreign journalists when people like you are so keen to have objective facts established by trustworthy outside sources?
Well, there are journalists there. There are Palestinian journalists there. Do you not accept
that? So we come back to the question. No, you've told me that I can't trust Palestinian figures.
There are journalists there.
Yes, why won't Israel allow foreign correspondents in? Why won't they allow Katya Adler in or Matt Fry? Why won't they allow Christiane Amanpour in? Why won't they allow people that have visited and reported on every other war zone in the world? And you're going to have to answer one of my questions.
My answer to you is, have you posed that question to them? Have you posed that question? Has the LBC posed that question? What's
to whom?
The answer they've given?
Pose that question to whom?
Have you posed the question to the Israeli authorities why they won't allow LBC, BBC, Sky, why they won't allow them? Have you posed that question?
I will when I get the opportunity to ask them, but right now I'm asking.
Sure, it's been posed.
Right now I'm asking you.
Well, I think it's
Answer to the question, Trevor. This is what you don't realise.
See,
you are the answer to the question, because if they allowed foreign correspondents in to provide independent verification, to provide international scrutiny, to report objectively, you wouldn't be able to ring this program and say the things that you've just said.
James, you know what? If there were journalists involved, what they would find is that arms in maternity wars,
you see?
Guns in pillowcases.
Yes, so then why wouldn't they? See, you've done it. You've proved
That's
my point even
find.
More powerfully. So
That's
everything, all of the journalists would discover things that completely support your position. So you must be furious that they're not allowed in.
No, because I trust the Israeli military authorities to make judgments that are
They've just killed three British aid workers. The people you trust to make judgments have just killed three British aid workers. Before you go, you remember when they shot three hostages who were wearing their underpants?
The Israeli hostages.
Yeah, the ones waving the white flags, wearing their underpants, who'd escaped. How's that? What's the latest on that investigation? From the people that you trust?
James, we're in the middle of a war. The fact that every single awful incident, like yesterday...
Are you going to answer one question that I've asked you, Trevor?
I've no idea if they've... I'm sure...
But these are the people that you trust. I'm just looking for... I'm looking for the grounds. What's the latest on that investigation? Because you're trusting them to conduct this investinvestation. What's the latest on the shooting of three Israeli hostages by the Israeli Defense Force? Wearing their underpants and waving... wearing their underpants and waving white flags. The hostages that we're told, and you believe, that countless civilians have to die to secure the release of.
Why do you put words in people's mouths? What do we have to... Where has anyone mentioned you're so polluted by your own... and corrupted by your own language?
Here we go.
You put words into my mouth that I never said.
You said that the war has to continue.
It would absolutely continue because they're facing.
And how many civilians have died so far? So that means the killing of civilians has to continue. I can't explain your own thoughts to you, Trevor. You have to take responsibility at least for them.
And I'm very happy to do that.
But except you're not, are you? Because you don't want independent journalists in the region. You don't want anybody to believe the figures that are provided by anybody other than the Israeli Defense Force, who you claim you trust completely, while you can't even tell me the state of the investigation into their shooting of the hostages that you claim the release of is the justification for the entire conflict in Gaza in the first place.
Why does the UK government support Israel in its war aims? Why do they
say that again?
Why does your government support Israel in its war aims at the moment? Why do they do that, James?
That's a brilliant question.
What do you think, James? Give me your own independent objective view of why England, the British government, is supporting Israel in its aims of destroying Hamas. Why do you think that is?
Well, they're not, are they?
Yeah, no,
they're not supporting. They've called. They have absolutely laid down a red line on Rafah. They've made it absolutely clear that they don't support war crimes. They've made it absolutely clear that they don't support a ground offensive. That they don't support a ground offensive in Rafah. And they've made it absolutely clear that the unnecessary killing of civilians is something that can't be countenanced. Israel riding roughshod over all of that, absolutely. Again, you make a brilliant point. Benjamin Netanyahu has made the British government look both ridiculous and weak.
I think the British government has been strong.
Hang on, you're asking me what I thought.
Okay.
So I'm answering your question. Benjamin Netanyahu has made the British government look ridiculous and weak, just as he has made you look ridiculous and weak.
Well,
and also profoundly wrong.
You personal, wish you reject my view.
But hang on, you just talked to me about pollution. You got personal first, Trevor. I'm only meeting you on your own battlefield.
I haven't defended your opinion or anything like that. But the British government.
So we'll return to what to me is the killer question, the most crucial question of all.
What is that?
And that is, why won't they let journalists in?
Perhaps it's too dangerous to have
the journalists. What the journalists make that decision.
Journalists made that decision. No, but it's for the military authority to decide whether it's prudent, given their military operations.
And then 2 minutes ago, you were reminding me that there are Palestinian journalists there.
Yes, there are. There are.
So why won't they let foreign correspondents who are absolutely chomping at the bit to get into Gaza, get into Gaza?
Well, I don't know. I don't understand.
You're not going to answer it. You know that. I know that.
No.
We know what the answer is. We know that it's because Israel cannot countenance what would actually be reported.
Hiding arms in maternity wards?
No, because they can't let journalists in, because if they did, you wouldn't be able to come on the radio and tell lies like that.
A lie of finding arms and finding munitions in a maternity ward, is that a lie?
Well, you tell me the journalists that have reported that.
No, you've just bold-faced said it was a lie, so obviously
yes,
you have evidence.
You tell me the journalists that have reported that. You tell me the journalists that have reported that. Or have you taken that from the same people that killed the three British aid workers yesterday?
I take that from the video evidence of the army who have gone in.
Say that again more slowly. The video evidence that who?
The video evidence from the Israeli army, from lady soldiers.
So there we are. And that's the answer to your question. They can't let journalists in, because then people like you wouldn't be able to take videos filmed by the actual soldiers killing the civilians as truth, would you?
Well, from your position, James, anything Israel says is obviously always going to be wrong.
Which is why you need independent journalists in there. Which is why you need independent journalists in there, Trevor. You see it now, finally.
So you're accepting Hamas's figure, which you're saying...
No, I'm accepting a Human Rights Watch's analysis of how the Palestinian Health Authority assembles its figures.
No, you're,
and you are reminding everybody listening why journalists aren't allowed in by Israel. Because you wouldn't then be required to rely on footage filmed by the actual soldiers killing the actual civilians, Trevor. But here you are, live on the radio, saying it out loud.
James, you're very good at contorting, distorting.
I'm not, that's Trevor. I'm very good at holding up mirrors and repeating people's words back to them.
You're an excellent journalist, but you use it to create...
I'm very good at repeating people's words back to them. Without you, Trevor, I'm nothing.
From this week, earlier on LBC, that was James O'Brien chatting to Trevor in Finchley. And I think a very, very good job he did, and excellent bit of journalism too. Be nice to see a bit more of that from the other channels, wouldn't it? Now we'll have a look at Craig Murray, because Craig, a former ambassador to Uzbekistan, is a great campaigner, several times guest on this programme. He's been over in Greece trying to get his, I think he's dislocated his hip or his shoulder, trying to get it set over there because it's taking far too long here in the UK. So he had to fly over to Greece to get that done. Anyway, he should be back by now. But he's explaining why he believes the United Nations must do armed intervention in Gaza.
I am Craig Murray. I wanted to talk to you urgently because I'm really worried that we are seeing the collapse of the fabric of international law, and even the abandonment of the idea of Western democracy. I was worried that the world was getting hardened, getting inured to the genocide in Gaza. I myself found I wasn't crying so much in October, November, December, when I saw pictures of dead babies, when I saw a small child burying an even smaller child, a brother carrying the body of his little sister, children crying over the corpse of their dead mother. I used to cry regularly. I don't do it so much now. I don't cry so much because I've seen so much of it. And I was worrying myself, you know, am I getting hardened? And there seemed less outrage in the world. The massacre at Al-Shifa Hospital that's taken place this last few days seems to have touched a nerve again in the world, certainly on social media. And it's just astonishing. It's incredible. You have doctors and surgeons executed. One lady doctor and her son, a surgeon, both killed. Many bodies found with their arms and legs tied together. Even children executed, children shot in close range. Hundreds of people dead. And then a hospital destroyed, burnt down, blown up, all the medical equipment deliberately destroyed. I've seen video of a child having its life support equipment turned off and being tipped onto the floor to die by IDF soldiers who themselves posted a video. And remember, back when this all started, Israelis first bombed Al-Shifa Hospital. They claimed it couldn't possibly be true. They would never bomb a hospital, and it was a Hamas misfire, even though the explosion was hundreds of times more powerful than anything Hamas have ever had. Their missiles don't have explosive warheads. They're just fireworks, basically. And Israel has now destroyed over 30 hospitals in Gaza. It's not the first time Israel's been into Al-Shifa. Previously, it had wiped out large parts of the hospital, and it certainly disarmed anybody in there. Remember, it found those few guns and in knapsacks. Everyone was rather dubious about four or five guns got in there. But they knew for certain that there wasn't a large-scale armed force in there, because they'd cleaned it out twice before already and been surrounding it ever since. How could there be? It's just massacre. Everyone knows it's massacre. Everyone knows it's genocide. And this comes days after, just days after, the International Court of Justice issued a second order of provisional measures, specifically ordering a ceasefire. Everyone knows this is a genocide. There's nobody in the world who doesn't know this is a genocide. There's some Zionists who support the genocide, who choose to deny it because that's politically useful, but of course they know it's a genocide, they just support it. Everyone knows Israel is in breach of international humanitarian law. You see a dozen videos a day on Twitter or YouTube showing breaches of international humanitarian law that pretends that it isn't by the UK, Germany, the European Union, United States, is pathetic. You know, it's just an obvious lie. And it's planned. I used to be in government. I was a British ambassador. I was a member of the senior management structure of the British Foreign Office for 6 years. A decision like the decision to cut funding to UNRWA can't be taken in a few hours, not in any country. In the UK, that would take at least a week of planning. There'd be submissions written to ministers. Other ministries with an interest have to be consulted. And there'd be meetings. Can't do it in a few hours. And after Israel produced these allegations, for which there is no evidence whatsoever of UNRWA involvement with Hamas, on the day the International Court of Judgment finding of plausible genocide came out, that very afternoon, all the Western nations, most of the Western nations, cut funding to UNRWA to help kickstart the starvation policy. And that was planned. No, that was coordinated and timed. It would have taken at least a week to plan that, to do all the coordination between all the different countries, to get it agreed through the ministries and government mechanisms of the different countries. That was a planned response to the ICJ report. These Western countries have been planning this genocide for months, if not years. And this coordinated line that Israel is not breaching international humanitarian law, when it plainly is, and when the latest ICJ ruling was unanimous, 15-0, ordering a complete ceasefire, which is responded to with the Al-Shifa massacre and with yet more bombings. And it's not just that this is destroying the fabric of international law. It's making a mockery of the Security Council. It's making a mockery of the International Court of Justice. But the whole fabric of post-1946 international law. I know many of you are skeptical about international law, but in fact it had many great achievements, the International Court of Justice. Dozens and dozens of rulings which have been respected. The UN has had success with peacekeeping forces and conflict resolution. All that is now abandoned, completely abandoned by the Western powers in order to promote the Zionist project. But that's not all that's abandoned. Democracy is abandoned. There's no Western country except perhaps Germany with their Holocaust guilt, but there's no Western country where the people do not want this stopped, do not want an end to this genocide, and where people can't see it's genocide. But in almost every country in the West, both the government and the main opposition party supports the genocide. That's certainly true in the United Kingdom, it's true in the United States, it's true in Germany, it's true in France. We have a political class which is supporting genocide. And that's to do with the fact that we have a political class which isn't responsive to the people at all, doesn't care what the people think. The political class is entirely in the pocket of billionaires. And our so-called democracy in most of our countries is a choice between voting for a government of one bunch of neoconservative, pro-genocidal Zionists, or voting for a different colour of neoconservative, pro-genocidal Zionists. And the contempt for the will of the people and the contempt for the notion of democracy and the sense of impunity of the political class, who are all complicit in genocide, the fact that they have the corrupt International Criminal Court, which is different from the International Court of Justice, but they have the corrupt International Criminal Court and its corrupt prosecutors in their pocket. The system has broken down. All of us today are upset, are raging about this genocide, and there's nothing we can do. There's no way at the moment we can influence our countries, which are supplying weapons, which are supplying intelligence, which are flying aerial surveillance to assist the Israelis, which are giving logistical support to the Israelis. And we can't stop them because our political systems are rotten. There is no leverage. The bond between the people and the political class is completely broken. They don't care about the people. They only care about the billionaires who are in charge of them and in charge of the media. And the media narratives we have seen, the difference between the truth that everybody in the world almost can see on their mobile phones about what's actually happening and the rubbish propaganda that the media is pumping out. Again, there's this total disconnect between reality and the socio-political system that we all live in. For me, it's a terrible warning. This dreadful, appalling, unbelievable thing that's happening to the Palestinian people. And our problem that we can't stop it. We have no levers to stop it. As a people, we have no levers to stop it. As ordinary citizens, there seems so little we can do. It's actually just a symptom of the fact there's nothing we can do to control our own lives either. There's nothing we can do to stop the massive and ever-growing gap between rich and poor. Stop the fact that the world is heading for its first trillionaires, while even in developed countries, people are sleeping on the streets and children live in poverty and education systems are collapsing. This is a terrible time for the world. What can be done? What should be done? Well, for now, let me just concentrate on Israel and Gaza. What needs to be done is a Security Council resolution under Chapter 7, which mandates action. That needs to mandate a ceasefire, mandate a no-fly zone, and it needs to mandate military forces to enforce it. And the mandate should be given to China and to South Africa, with others who wish to join them, to lead a force to militarily put an end to this genocide. It's time that China stood up and took on responsibilities that come with being the world's economic power, and it has the military power to do it if it has the will. And we need to see that kind of Chapter 7 resolution introduced at the United Nations. And if the United States and the United Kingdom keep vetoing it, as I'm sure they will, that will only show still further the gap between the people and the political class and may eventually be part of what leads us on to action. I'm sorry, I wish I could sound more hopeful. I think all of us today feel a blackness of despair of what's happening in Gaza. We must all of us, take every single political action within our power to try to end it. Thank you very much.
Craig Murray there explaining why he believes UN armed intervention is necessary in Gaza. Some excellent points he's making too. And who knows, maybe that will happen. Who knows? I mean, although the United States will probably veto everything, won't they? Well, on to Borman now. Amazing discovery for me this week is this amazing. I mean, I've never come across her at all. And it's not surprising because she's kept her head down. Elsa Kruger was Martin Bormann's secretary. Now, if you remember, Martin Bormann started the war up until 1941, this Nazi that I've written a book about, which is The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. Bormann was over there as the secretary, private secretary to Rudolf Hess. He was the deputy Führer. But then when Hess flew away, suddenly Bormann was promoted to becoming, well, I think it's called Reichsleiter, that is the head of the Nazi party. So he was in charge of all the promotions within the Nazi party. You know, very, very powerful position. But he was also the secretary on all the bank accounts. And it looks very, very clear that the British managed to get him out at the end of the war, bring him over, that is using Ian Fleming and Naval Intelligence and John Ainsworth Davis and the commandos trained down in Hayling Island to bring him out of Berlin right under the noses of the Russians, 1st or 2nd of May 1945, along the canals. Whenever they were challenged by the Russians, there was a lady on board in a Russian army uniform who spoke fluent Russian who would shout at them and say, "We're looking for Nazi, we're pursuing Nazi war criminals. And Marshal Zhukov will have you court-martialed if you stop us. Out of our way." And she said it all in Russian, in a Russian army uniform. So that's how they managed to blag their way through the Russian lines and eventually came to a town called Verben, which is just inside the British sector, where on the ramp is waiting Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, to take Martin Bormann, the signatory on the billion or so dollars worth of loot that had been, stolen from the whole of, looted, hadn't it, from the whole of Europe by the Nazis. So, amazing little story, and it's really the story of what happened to the Nazi gold. Where did it go? The two most important books on this really are the Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, the former CBS correspondent during the war over in Europe for the American radio audience. And then John Ainsworth Davis published his book about 15 years later in 1996, Op JB, to explain how Bormann was actually gotten out from Berlin and brought back to Britain. And the great thing about Op JB is it's got Winston Churchill and Lord Mountbatten's blessing, letters from both of them endorsing it, or at least saying, "Yes, you can write this story now we're dead," or, you know, "Once we're dead," that kind of thing. So anyway, let's have a listen now to this latest from Mark Fenton, which is only out a couple of weeks ago, but is a fantastic investigation into this lady Elsa Kruger, who was Bormann's secretary, also managed to, funnily enough, make her way to Britain, but even more amazingly, married Leslie James of British Intelligence and lived up in the Wirral and then moved down to Cambridge. The whole idea here being that she's actually a British housewife that no one even knows was a top Nazi who was in the Führer bunker at the end of the Second World War.
It appeared that Kruger was intent on going northwest towards where Grand Admiral Dönitz's new government was in operation, which would take her into British-controlled territory. Bormann had apparently urged Kruger to only fall into British hands if she was to be captured, claiming that, quote, "the British will behave like gentlemen," end quote. Don't forget, Kruger came from Hamburg and would have had relations and friends still living in the area. And Hamburg was indeed captured by the British on the 3rd of May 1945. She probably felt most comfortable with the British, as she and her sister had worked as au pairs in Britain in the 1930s, working for the families of managers of Shellmex, the work arranged by Sir Henry Detterding, who heavily funded the Nazi Party during its early years and died in 1939. After leaving the brewery, the women split into two groups. Traudl Junger and Constanze Manziali in one, and Kruger and Gerda Christian in the other. Junger left Manziali to go and try to find some civilian clothes for both of them, and returned to see Manziali being led towards a U-Bahn station entrance by two armed Soviet soldiers. She was never seen alive again. Traudl Junger went on alone. Her intention was to reach the British zone as well, but lacking any money, no papers and no luggage, she nonetheless made it to the countryside outside of Berlin, walking for several days, sleeping in barns or sometimes in farmhouses, and being given the odd bits of food and clothing along the way. Incredibly, whilst on the run, she ran into another Führerbunker fugitive, SS Obersturmbannführer Erich Kempke, Hitler's chief driver, who was on his way to try to cross the Elbe River. In fact, Kempke made it all the way to Berchtesgaden in Bavaria, being apprehended by US troops on the 20th of June 1945. Junge couldn't reach Western Allied lines, and eventually she went back to Berlin, arriving in June 1945 and was eventually identified and picked up by the Soviets. She was later released into the British sector of West Berlin in December 1945, suffering from diphtheria. As for Christian and Kruger, their journey was somewhat different. According to statements made by Kruger and Christian, they managed to get to British lines by somehow getting themselves aboard a repatriation train returning French forced labourers from the Soviet zone, themselves posing as French female workers. Apparently their cover was seen through by French officers on the train, who had the Soviets haul the two women off of it. However, after speaking to the British train commander, he smuggled them back aboard. In this manner, Bormann's secretary and Hitler's secretary disappeared into the chaos of northwestern Germany. If you recall, the two women had in their possession a letter from Dr. Goebbels for Reich President Dönitz, an odd thing to be carrying in a breakout attempt. Could such a high-level letter have been some kind of covering note issued to the couriers carrying copies of Hitler's last will and testament to Dönitz? Whatever its purpose or contents, we will never know. So what became of this fascinating historical object? In the letter I found in the archives from Kruger to Hugh Trevor Roper, dated the 22nd of February 1977, she tells us, quote, "We had a letter from Goebbels to Dönitz, and this, together with personal papers, we tore into pieces and flushed down a lavatory within hours after leaving Berlin." End quote. Elsa Kruger settled in Hamburg and began work as a clerk in an office, but was eventually identified and picked up by British military police for questioning. She was one of the key witnesses to the inner workings of Hitler's government and court, and as Bormann's chief secretary, she had been privy to immense amounts of information concerning Bormann's activities. She was also one of only a handful of people who had successfully escaped the Führerbunker and made it to the West. Most of the others were either dead, missing, or in Soviet detention. She was subjected to interrogations by both British and American intelligence, keen to find out Hitler's fate and that of Bormann. But here things are a little strange. She did speak at length with then-Major Hugh Trevor Roper of the Intelligence Corps, who used her memories as a major part of his 1947 best-selling book, The Last Days of Hitler. But it was the relationship she developed with her other British Army interrogator, Captain Leslie James of the Intelligence Corps, that raises eyebrows still. When she appeared at the Nuremberg trial, a newspaper article noted of Kruger, quote, "Tall, blue-eyed, with a great shock of honey-coloured hair, Miss Kruger enjoyed Hitler's admiration because he believed she corresponded to his Nordic racial theories," end quote. Kruger also had Captain James's admiration, and the two formed a relationship while she was in British custody, a relationship that became official once she was released. The one topic of conversation she avoided was her erstwhile employer. "He's got her trained like a poodle," was Hoffmann's disgusted assessment of Fraulein Kruger. End quote. And this was to be Kruger's attitude to the subject of Bormann and Hitler for the rest of her long life. Almost complete refusal to discuss that period of her life, and like Countess Kalnocki and Heinrich Hoffmann, many others have wondered whether she had something to hide. After her release from British custody in 1947, Kruger moved to England with her former interrogator, Captain James, who had been demobilised. They married at Wallasey Registry Office at Christmas 1947 and moved into Ivy Cottage, Green Lane in Wallasey, outside Liverpool. Locals thought Mrs. James was Danish and accepted her as a war bride. Leslie James, pursuing a career as an academic, gaining his PhD. No one knew of her previous life as Martin Bormann's secretary. A son, Harold, was born in 1956 when Kruger was 41 years old, but no other children followed. At this time, Kruger and her husband were living in Bedford. Dr. James took a post teaching at Cambridge University in the late 1960s, and Elsa was not bothered by her past until she was approached by former U.S. intelligence officer James P. O'Donnell, who was researching his now famous book, The Berlin Bunker. This is where the problems started. O'Donnell managed to track Kruger down to Cambridge, and she and her husband were living at 1 Lansdowne Road, a leafy suburb of the city. She spoke only briefly to O'Donnell about the war. Quote, "After all these years, she fights tooth and nail to stop the truth coming out," said O'Donnell to the Liverpool Echo in May 1985. Quote, "Personally, whenever I have met her, she strikes me as being hard and not at all pleasant. I wonder if she feels remorse," end quote. O'Donnell's book was due to be published in the UK and US in 1979, but for a couple of years before, Kruger fought tooth and nail to have passages of O'Donnell's manuscript changed or deleted that mentioned her and her activities. I was able to find three unpublished letters she sent to none other than Hugh Trevor Roper, the man who had interrogated her back in 1945, outlining her legal battles over O'Donnell's book and the help that Trevor Roper had given to the couple.
So that's one of Mark Fenton's latest investigations, brilliant bit of work, on Elsa Kruger, who married Leslie James from British Intelligence, and she was in the Hitler bunker. So she's a Bormann secretary, but also an innocent and not saying very much British housewife. Fascinating tale, and again, adds credence to the idea that Bormann was brought to Britain by British intelligence. So the whole purpose was to create this sort of elite organisation, British and American, the Bilderbergers, after the war. That's what they were doing. They were laundering the money through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm in New York, injecting it, as Paul Manning explains, into these newly formed companies, newly formed by Bormann, and putting Jews in charge of those companies to disguise the fact that it was actually Nazi money that had been laundered to get those companies going. And I think you find it quite difficult to sort of manage to get yourself appointed to the board. It's basically a Fourth Reich cult that they were running after the war. When I spoke to Kees van der Peil the other day, he also talked quite a lot about... This amazing character, in great detail actually, who married into the Dutch royal family, Prince Bernhard, who was a Nazi agent and was involved in the Battle of Arnhem in helping to overturn the result, really as a spy for the Nazis in the British High Command. There's an amazing picture of the 30 Corps General Horrocks plus Monty and Prince Bernhard peering over their shoulder, you know, the Nazi agent peering over their shoulder in beginning of September 1944, just before the Battle of Arnhem. And there's a lot of reasons, you know, that start stacking up about why that battle was a disaster, to buy the Nazis more time, to squirrel away their wealth, to create this Fourth Reich and to do deals for safe passage after the war with unscrupulous British and, I suppose, American too. But the most important thing for me from the book's point of view is this looks at the relationship between Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill's private secretary, and Martin Bormann, Adolf Hitler's private secretary. They were like that, he says, with his thumb and his forefinger rather close to each other. Anyway, so this section is looking at Bernhard particularly, and Kees van der Peil is very much aware of who he was, the first chairman of the Bilderberg conferences back in the mid-1950s.
In the early 50s, there was a network that began in wartime London, which was then formed in under Prince Bernhard, the Dutch prince consort, of German background, himself a former SS officer, who had been told by Hitler in a private interview to try and pick up one of these European princesses, either in Denmark or in the Netherlands. And of course, Prince Bernhard came to our country, and he was active in wartime London. The Bilderberg was founded and was also the most important until at least the early 70s as an Atlantic network. And its history, as you well know, is very important because it's very instructive also, because it tells you that we're not looking here at a conspiracy of a group of like-minded people who know from the start what they're after. But it was set up as a private, you know, behind closed doors series of meetings, because there was intense disagreement between the United States and the European countries, because West Germany, for instance, Germany was then still split in two halves, or three on the one side and one on the other. In Germany especially, German business wanted to do, to trade with Eastern Europe, with the Soviet bloc. And that was something. And they also wanted to trade with China after 1949, after the communist revolution there. And that was something that was anathema to the U.S. side. So they decided to have closed-door meetings to thrash out their differences and arrive at some sort of minimum consensus. And that tells you that these networks have that as their main function. So they have to sit together, not because they have a plan already, but to come up with a plan, taking into account various viewpoints, which very often are difficult to reconcile. Bilderberg was most important until the 1970s, when it was the opinion of people like members like David Rockefeller of the famous banking dynasty, oil and banking dynasty, you know, Chase Manhattan at the time, that somehow Japan should be brought in, and that became the Trilateral Commission. Bilderberg, meanwhile, got into a serious crisis because it turned out that too many members or regular attendees had become weapon dealers in their own right, especially selling airplanes to Europe. So in the 1970s and early 80s, the Trilateral Commission, trilateral because Japan was added to North America and Europe, Western Europe, the Trilateral Commission became more important. And in the 1980s, they all receded more or less in the background, because nationalistic networks like the Heritage Foundation in the United States came to the fore and became more prominent, always with essentially the same people on board, although there were many new rich and speculative capitalists prominent in the Heritage Foundation, more than in Bilderberg and the Trilateral before it. Early in the 90s, I mean, there are many more of these networks, but the most important one is, of course, the World Economic Forum. But it only became the most important one, actually, in the run-up to the COVID crisis and in the unfolding of the COVID crisis. So between these different networks, which have different backgrounds, you know, due to the different historic settings in which they emerged, but there's also competition between them and the World Economic Forum under Klaus Schwab, famous for his German accent, is really the most important today, I would say. The others that you mentioned already, like the G30, you know, the retired financial chiefs, heads of of the key central banks and so on, they are also important, but not so comprehensive. They are more important in their own field, in this case in finance. So the World Economic Forum is really the most prolific in writing blueprints for what they think the future should look like. And that is everybody working from home, everybody studying from home. If you're not well, you type your complaint into your laptop, and you get maybe you're asked for a photograph or this or that body part, and then you get your subscription also online. That is the worldview of and the view of the future of the World Economic Forum, a complete digitalized and hence atomized society, especially in the advanced part, the richest part of the world.
Look, can I ask you a bit about the change in politics? One of the things you point out was also a subject of a Adam Curtis documentary The Power of Nightmares, which is about the sort of change in the idea of what politics is there for, that politicians now are there to sort of sell, in a way like a kind of salesman, the idea that they're not going to be quite as bad as another politician. They're also talking a lot about fear, again, about fear. This whole concept of threats to people seems to be very dominant, and there doesn't really seem to be anything in terms of a genuine positive vision for governments in the West, democratic governments that actually serve the day-to-day needs of society. So an obvious problem for many people is this cost of living crisis, as they call it, which is, a massive increase in rents, food costs, and the fact that people are much more indebted than they were in the 1970s. So this whole change of vision from, we can offer you housing, and a future, and your family and your children's children will have a better world. Now we're getting this. So can you just say something about the way that's changed around?
Yeah. Well, after, in the 1930s, in the United States, the capitalist class was forced to make serious concessions to the working class. And these concessions were not a revolution in themselves, but they did change the balance of forces to such an extent that you could speak of a real class compromise. There was a class compromise between the upper class, the middle classes, and the organized working class. After the war, that was brought to Western Europe through the Marshall Plan and under slightly different circumstances also to Japan and later to South Korea, but under even more repressive regimes. And the middle class always profited most from this class compromise. But at least the workers, until the 1970s, when inflation got a free hand, owing to the U.S. decision to cut the dollar from gold so that you got an inflation of 10% per year simply in terms of the amount of dollars in circulation. But until the 1970s, workers' wages, again, for the organized working class, so trade union members, remained fairly constant. After that, they began to slip away due to inflation and the fight of the workers mainly became to get some sort of inflation compensation. And one year after the next, they began to lose those fights. And industry began to move out and so on and so forth. The middle class, on the other hand, retained an element of compromise because they were an asset-owning class. They had their own house. Occasionally they had some. They had pensions. They had maybe some investments here and there beside their own house. That remained in force until 1979. So in the 1980s, you got a different situation, in which the entire element of class compromise began to evaporate. And it was in that period, and especially after 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the world's balance of forces completely capsized to the benefit of the capitalist side, and the workers and generally the populations of Western capitalist countries were losing. After 1991, a serious quest began, because as always, the ruling class is the first to understand the real situation, because they are with many. They have all these think tanks to organize thinking and collective decision making and consensus formation. They realized that something had to take the place of what used to be class compromises, in which for the workers and then for the middle class, there was also something that you could hope for. And after 1991, capital was no longer willing to accept any political direction. Something had to be discovered or developed to make sure that the large mass of the population would remain in line. And you have, for instance, Samuel Huntington's article on the clash of civilizations, which contradicted the original optimism of Francis Fukuyama, you know, the end of history, no more world conflicts and this and that. And Huntington said it will always be conflict because we are living in civilizations that are perennially fighting each other. Liberalism in the West, Islam, Confucianism, as he very, very doubtful intellectually, but powerful in its appeal. And in 1998, there was an explicit conference dedicated to a new sort of politics that was needed, and that was presided over by Philip Zelikow, a key figure in the Bush Jr. administration. And he said what is necessary is a sort of event that for a generation will shape people's minds in terms of why what they have is already nice enough, you know, to keep people in line, basically. And that 9/11 was in 9/11 that became reality. So Zelikow was actually the editor of the official 9/11 report, which is just a bag of lies and a whitewash. Of course, there was also the project for a new American century, which today should be read again, their reports, because they too said all the changes that they proposed to make sure that the United States gets back on top had come true. But they also included things like using enhanced viruses, laboratory enhanced viruses, to selectively wage biological warfare. So they said we should develop differential biological weapons which will affect one particular ethnic category of people, but not us. Or at least we should have vaccines against it. Well, that's the practical application of this politics of fear. So that eventually became the COVID. Why the COVID crisis was timed in 1990 has many possible causes. In the book, I mention that at any price they wanted to prevent a re-election of Trump. And that worked, of course. They also had to deal with a possible new financial collapse of the type of 2008. But most of the elements of the COVID crisis were already being developed by various branches of government involved, essentially the security, national security state, in combination with the IT giants, which are merely the internet arm, so to speak, of the national security state, and the media, which in the 1990s were subject to a massive concentration, which brought most of them into the hands of a handful of billionaire oligarchs who had these newspapers and media channels. More or less as a plaything, because these days you don't make much money on a newspaper. So if a man like Jeff Bezos of Amazon has the Washington Post, it's not because he wants to get rich from it, because he's losing money on a daily basis for that newspaper. But when he opens the newspaper in the morning, he reads at least what he wants to read, and not rabble-rousing stuff.
Case van der Pale there, author of States of Emergency and A Pandemic of Angst in Different Languages. I think The Pandemic of Angst is German or Dutch. but the States of Emergency is the main book. But he's also a great expert on the Bilderbergers, good old Kees van der Peil. Also speaking on Easter Sunday in Amsterdam at the big Gaza Peace Rally. So that's that little section. So we've looked at Elsa Kruger. We've also had a good look there at Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, their role in creating these fascist organisations to control politics in the NATO countries after World War II. But what about John Harris? He's a great writer. He looks into the whole Rudolf Hess story and the mysterious flight of Rudolf Hess to Britain, and he's right to keep going on that. Here he is explaining how immediately Hess landed, the lies started. So they were saying that, he jumped out of the plane in a parachute, the ME-110 that he flew to Britain mysteriously in 1941, the Deputy Führer, to supposedly try and make a peace deal. He crash-landed up in Scotland, actually. He crash-landed. He didn't come out in a parachute. Here's John Harris explaining some of the evidence that, first of all, that there was lies told immediately about, to try and make him look stupid. Oh, he's had to parachute out of his plane. He's that bad a pilot. But actually, he crash landed next to a house that he did believe was the Duke of Hamilton's, who was a right wing guy who Hess had been told wanted to conduct a coup in Britain.
You can see today the remnants of the plane. There are two engines which are in pretty good condition. One's in East Fortune Air Museum. The other is in Duxford Air Museum. Both are in quite good condition. The fuselage is also in RAF Duxford. What we've never seen is the cockpit, for reasons I'll go into in a little while. But we've all seen Time Team and programmes like that where crashed aircraft are dug out from a huge hole in the ground 20 or 30 foot deep. These engines and these fuselages certainly were not anywhere near damaged to that extent. It's almost as if the plane has been crash landed, and that's the other debate. Was Hess lying about the parachute? Because I think there's only one person that alleges to have seen a parachute, whereas there are stories about helping Hess out of a crashed plane. So a lot of people think that Hess actually crash-landed the plane, and that explains, A, why he's in the same field as the plane, and B, why the plane is so, why the plane components are so undamaged. So then the debate goes as to why would the authorities try and make the story that he'd parachuted when he'd actually crash-landed the plane? Why would that news management take place? And the only explanation we've ever come up with that I think is vaguely satisfactory is that a parachute is a very random act, whereas a crash landing is a very pre-planned event. Is it that by promulgating the story of a parachute landing, it tries to infer that it was a random act of a madman? So we're back.
Yeah, well, he's panicking, you know, that sort of thing.
It's the delusional madman stealing the plane and flying to the enemy and then jumping out. It reinforces that story almost. I think we believe the likelihood is he crash landed the plane.
So that's the author John Harris there talking to me about one of his latest books on Rudolf Hess, explaining that he actually deliberately crash landed or did an emergency landing in a field rather than parachuted out of the plane. The lies started straight away. Well, look, another author who's written about much more ancient and much more modern things is David Livingstone. I'd love to have a chat with him every few months, really. And there's no need for an excuse this time, because he's just come out with a new book. It's called Zionism, The History of a Jewish Heresy. And here I'm chatting to him a little bit about, the connection between the build-up to Zionism and what's taking place today.
I mean, the biggest con that the Zionists have pulled off is that they somehow represent the Jewish community as a totality. And they are a heresy that have managed to gain control over only over the last couple hundred years, and to a large extent with some substantial help from the Rothschilds. If you look at the history of Zionism, the Rothschilds are there every step of the way. Even the Balfour Declaration itself was written and dedicated, well, written to Lord Walter Rothschild. So it's basically, you know, a combination of the extraordinary wealth building power of interest banking that put substantial funds at their disposal, and they use those funds to advance the voices put forward, give prominence to the voices of these heretics, particularly the Sabbateans, because it's also the followers of Moses Mendelssohn who were involved in, again, the Frankfurt Judenlodge, who created two modern branches of Judaism, in fact, three modern branches of Judaism. There's Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, and Neo-Orthodox Judaism. And so this is how now Jewish tradition has been estranged from its true orthodoxy. And but really, if you look at the state of Israel, it's really just it's the ability of the Zionists to disguise themselves as somehow a legitimate element of the community to be able to and to have exercise enough political power so that they could basically seize seize the forefront of the Jewish community. But, you know, this is what, to go back to the point, so I try to make it short because there's a lot more detail I could go into, but I try to make it brief. But basically, so out of Moses Mendelssohn, you've got this twin track. And you've got one, which is the development of Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism through his influence. And the other one is German nationalism. And that happens through his influence through various members of the Illuminati, like I said, Friedrich Schlegel and Gottfried Herder. And the another one is Gottlieb Fichte. There's a whole other series of members of the Illuminati that he had an important influence on, like Schelling and Schiller. Basically, the entire list, most of the people who were the founding figures of what's called Weimar Classicism and the German Romantic movement. And what's important is that this movement was sponsored by Karl August of Saxe-Weimar-Eisenach, who, because Eisenach, the city town of Eisenach, is the location of Wartburg Castle, and he could trace his descent back to the Knights One. So according to last name, Richard Houston Chamberlain, who was the Wagner's son-in-law, and one of the most important promoters of his racist ideas, or expanded on his racist ideas, was said that Richard Wagner's mother was actually the daughter of Carl August's brother, meaning that Wagner himself could claim descent from the Night Swan. And Wagner is an important character because, so Wagner is really the key person who inspired, gave the most inspiration to the German nationalistic movement, and why he was so important to Hitler, but also paradoxically to Herzl. So, but Richard Wagner was born in the Jewish neighborhood of Leipzig. His real father, why it turns out he knew himself, and this is what Nietzsche accused him of, is that his real father was Jewish. If you look at the entire network of Wagner's friends, they all belong to either the Asiatic Brethren or linked to it, or they were members of the Frankfurt Judenlodge. One of Wagner's important early operas was Rienzi. That's the opera that most influenced Hitler. It's based, first of all, the person who helped him put it together was a guy named Giacomo Meyerbeer, whose father was one of the founders of the Hamburg Temple, which gave birth to the, founded by Israel Jacobson and a disciple of Moses Mendelssohn, which gave birth to the Jewish Reform Movement. And the Hamburg Temple is central to the Jewish Reform Movement. That's how it's from there that those traditions were imported in the United States. So this Meyerbeer was just one of a entire network of basically crypto Frankists who were associated with the Asiatic Branding and Frankfurt Reunion Lodge that were associated around Wagner. Like I said, Rienzi was based on a novel written by Edward Bulwer Lytton, who was initiated into the Frankfurt Reunion Lodge and then became the central figure of the occult revival. There's two principal influences behind the Nazi movement, and that's Edward Bulwer Lytton and Helena Blavatsky, who basically created the sort of modern mythologized version of the Aryan race. And it was Bulwer Lytton's novel, The Coming Race, and the idea of a Vril, which inspired the Nazis and, of course, the founding of what's supposedly the Vril Society and the Thule Society. And it was basically that movement that Bulwer Lytton gave birth to, which eventually evolved in the creation of the Golden Dawn. To make another shortcut, because we're not going to be able to talk about all these points together, but Bram Stoker, who was a member of the Golden Dawn, was the author of Dracula. Bram Stoker's main consultant on vampire culture, which he resorted to write Dracula, was I think his name is Junius van Berry, who was a friend of Theodor Herzl. When Herzl was going around trying to arrange meetings with people like the Sultan of Turkey, it was van Berry who was arranging it. That's a whole other topic we can go into. But basically, Wagner, what you see now is coming out of this Weimar network of German romantics and people like Schlegel all around, around Moses Mendelssohn, like Schlegel and Herder, which gave birth to the elements that gave rise to German nationalism. It started to evolve over the entire length of the 19th century. And at a certain point, this is where Wagner enters into the scene, and he plants in a very important element and really begins the sort of focus on anti-Semitism. But because now you're looking at what happens, is this is around the same time that the idea of even the term itself, anti-Semitism, is introduced. Because until that point, until 1880, there was because it was that year that there was a famous anti-Semitic petition that was written, which was based on the idea, which rejected the idea that Jews could be identified as a religion and that they should be identified as a race. But when you look at the participants in that petition, most of them were linked to the Frankists, because at the core, the Frankists are anti-Jewish. From the beginning, they rejected the Talmud, again, I said, in favor of the Zohar, and they practiced a religion which was basically heavily opposed to Orthodox tradition. So they are effectively, is a civil war within the Jewish movement, and so they were out to sideline Orthodox Judaism, and they managed to gain prominence, again, I said, through the financial support of the Rothschilds. So when you look in, that's why when you look in, what you're seeing is that basically there's parallel traditions out of the same origin from Moses Mendelssohn and the Frankists. One trajectory ended up through Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, and Zionism, and the other one through people like Wagner, Edward Bulwer Lytton, and Blavatsky to the Nazis. And that's how these two elements sort of played into each other, because Zionism effectively is dependent on anti-Semitism.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it sounds to me like they're controlling both sides of the chessboard.
It seems to be the case, yes. Really, everybody around Hitler was immersed in the occult, including Rudolf Hess, Heinrich Himmler, and, you know, entire gamut of Haushofer, and so on and so forth. Most of them were members of the Thule Society, and it's a well-known fact that the Nazi Party was an outgrowth or renaming, effectively, of the German Workers' Party, which was created by the Thule Society. Because what happens is that the after gaining power, the Thule Society, Thule Society through the, it's called the Münchener Beobachter, which is the Munich Observer, which they took over. Sebettendorf bought it, and then they changed its name to the Völkischer Beobachter, and it was operated by the Eheverlag, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And through the Eheverlag, the Nazis effectively managed to gain control of the vast majority. I think it was in 90% of the German press, and it's through the German press. Because this is what really struck me with my recent research, is to what extent the Nazis had created a cult of personality. And that cult was externalization of the Thule belief that Hitler was the Messiah. And this is how they developed the idea of what's called the Führer Prinzip, which is the Führer principle. And the idea that Hitler was some kind of unquestionable guide. And this is how they effectively worshipped that as a Messiah, that every command he gave was to be... that's what the idea of the Führer Prinzip is. Every commandment he gave was to be accepted without question, because he was the Führer, effectively the Messiah, who could not effectively see anything wrong. And so that's basically what transformed the German society and made them accomplish what they were able to do, is because it was the Thule Society working behind the scenes, preserving this crackpot as being, he's basically a failed, you know, twice a failed applicant to an art school, former male prostitute, lived in tenement houses. And then just because supposedly he's a loudmouth, that they, you know, believe this guy to be a Messiah, and they actually gave them command of one of the most powerful states in the world. And again, based on the idea that he was some kind of strange Aryan Messiah, which I would attribute to originally Kabbalistic influence, but because we have to not interpret him as the Messiah in the conventional sense that we have, but in a sort of a Gnostic one, where he is a Messiah of chaos, here to produce the sort of chaos necessary for accelerating the coming of the end times.
So David Livingstone nicely rounding up there, talking about the connection between Zionism and this whole idea of accelerationism, trying to accelerate the end of the world to bring about some kind of world government based in Jerusalem. Well, that's looking increasingly less likely. And the full version of that will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. So as we start to wind down to the spiritual section at the end of the show, let's have a listen to Isabel Vaughan Spruce. Now, she was arrested for praying, but she has a lot to say, very interesting stuff to say, about these abortion buffer zones and the demonization of the pro-life movement generally, but also about how what they're trying to do is to stop people thinking. I mean, she's really here talking about thought crime.
We had a similar problem in Birmingham, not the same as Ealing, but you can certainly see the parallels. My volunteers were frequently abused by some locals in the neighbourhood. And this might be verbal abuse, like swearing and just being screamed at. There was physical assaults on people that we sometimes even caught on camera. We would have cars racing down the street towards us at high speed and veering off at the last minute. Men would be saying to young women that they were going to be followed home and things would happen to their families. Property was stolen. Just the most horrible situations that were happening pretty much on a daily basis. Wow. And yet we talked to the police about it and they said, well, if you don't want to be assaulted, you don't have to come out of your house, do you? And like you say, you know, clearly they could see that the amount of abuse and harassment was going up in the neighbourhood, but it was us who were the victims of that. And actually bringing in this buffer zone did nothing but move that to further down the road where my volunteers now pray outside a church, which is just outside the buffer zone. And yet they've still been assaulted there. They've still been sworn at and spat at. And, you know, the harassment has still continued against them. And actually what these buffer zones have done, they've actually fostered a real sense of intolerance in that neighbourhood. Because many of those people now, well, I was going to say now they feel they're above the law. They do seem to be above the law, some of them. Because like I say, we've shown incidents of physical assault to the police and still nothing has happened. So it doesn't really solve the problem, these buffer zones. It actually just moves it further away and intensifies it. The UK, which, like you say, used to be somewhere where we would certainly associate free speech with, has now almost made it criminal to have certain thoughts in certain areas. We're not even talking about speech. It's literally our thoughts that are being censored. And I know recently I was part of a session where they were discussing this up in Scotland. And I saw the Minister for Public Health and Women's Health, Jenny Minto, really floundering, trying to justify, you know, why silent prayer was dangerous. Because we can see there's an agenda going on there that pro-lifers have actually become sort of like some kind of social pariah, you know, for whether it's generally Christians, just for simply wanting to pray on the streets. And this is really, really concerning. And I think, you know, one of the things we have to look at is how the language that we use has really got us to where we are. You know, we've talked for a long time about the protests that happen. And I know, I actually don't really know anyone that protests outside abortion centres in this country. I'm not saying it doesn't happen in any places, but in this country, it's generally just peaceful vigils that happen. And we know that in 2018, there was actually an investigation done, you know, on what was happening outside abortion centres. And it was shown that it was largely just peaceful vigils that were taking place, and that there was no need for anything further to be done. And yet we see that the language that's used, whenever there's articles written about my vigil, you know, we see this really negative language that's used. And it's not really surprising that when people do come for abortions, they might actually be feeling quite nervous and quite afraid because they've believed what is written about it. And I feel quite sorry for a lot of these women that are coming along thinking that someone's going to be shouting murderer at them and running along the street after them and, you know, forcing them to have leaflets they don't want and things like this. And of course, when they get there, nothing of the kind happens. But that doesn't stop the fear being there because they've believed what's been read. Like you say, there is a push to make abortion up till birth for any and every reason. But it's not called that. It's called decriminalisation because that sounds a lot more palatable and we'll get a lot more people supporting that. But if you actually ask the average person on the street, would they support abortion up till birth for any reason? No, they would not. And in fact, the average person on the street wouldn't support what we've got. A lot of people don't even know that, you know, a child that's diagnosed with Down syndrome can be aborted right up until birth. Equally, for a cleft palate, something that's very easily treated, that can be aborted, like I say, right up until birth. And some of these children are aborted right late term into the pregnancy. Again, we have another form of discrimination. Either it is a child or it isn't a child. And after 24 weeks, you know, most children aren't allowed to be aborted. But if they've got some kind of disability, they are. What terrible discrimination that is against those with disability.
Isabel Vaughan Spruce there, who was arrested for praying, would you believe? And that's, I suppose, the idea really is to try and stop people thinking a certain way, isn't it? It's all kind of coercion. But anyway, finally this week, Solomon and the Mark of the Beast. This is an old piece, I think fascinating. It's about the idea that we've now got these things manifesting in the news that are there in the Book of Revelation. Absolutely riveting, really.
The Bible predicts something called the mark of the beast. It says that this mark will be placed on people everywhere in the days just before Jesus returns. The mark of the beast is only mentioned in one place in the entire Bible. Well, in parts of two chapters of the Revelation of Jesus Christ, the last book of the Bible. It's described in the last few verses of the 13th chapter and in the first few verses of the 14th chapter. It is a mark which is placed in the right hand or on the forehead of people all over the world. Without this mark, according to the prophecy, they cannot buy or sell anything. The prophecy goes on to say that anyone who accepts that mark will receive the wrath of God without measure. So it's considered to be pretty bad. That phrase, without measure, means the unmitigated, strongest possible, pure wrath of God. Accepting that mark is apparently the point of no return for the human soul. It's pretty scary stuff. And yet this mark is not referred to anywhere else in the Bible. Jesus never mentions it once in any of the four Gospels. Or does he? I'm going to show in this video how the mark of the beast dovetails in with the ultimate revelation of Jesus Christ, and how that revelation began in the four Gospels and finishes in the last book of the Bible, the one called the Revelation of Jesus Christ. But first, let us just forget about the mark of the beast and take a grand overview of God's revelation of himself to mankind throughout history. There have been many ways in which God has revealed himself to the human race, not least of which is the creation itself. The universe and all that it contains, right down to the tiniest atoms and molecules. Modern science has enabled us to appreciate more and more each day just how vast the universe is, as well as how intricate the tiniest particles are. As the psalmist says, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. But in terms of understanding God's precise will for us as human beings, it is widely recognized that the 66 books of the Christian Bible represent the most comprehensive and the most reliable evidence of God's plan for his creation. These many books were written by dozens of different authors, spread over thousands of years. And within those 66 books, the purest revelation of the mind and character of God comes in the first four books of the New Testament, where we read of the life and we hear the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, the one they call the Christ, God in human form. In that life and in those teachings are revealed the greatest love and the greatest wisdom that the world has ever known. This Christ, this Savior of the world, is referred to in several places in the Bible as the cornerstone. That one piece without which mankind will never achieve his true destiny. If we zoom in even closer, scrolling through nearly 100 chapters in those four Gospels, we discover something called the Sermon on the Mount, a three-chapter condensation of the most significant teachings of Jesus. This sermon appears in the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matthew's Gospel. At the end of that great sermon, Jesus says that anyone who hears those teachings and builds his or her life on them will be building on a rock. Nothing, not even death itself, will be able to shake them. They will find refuge, not from all the trials of life, for we all must pass through some testing times, but they will find refuge from the wrath of God, and they will find peace, eternal peace, with God, our Heavenly Father. Now, let us move even closer to the very corner of that cornerstone, the tip of God's purest expression of himself. Right there, in the middle of the middle chapter of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus speaks, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust corrupts, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. Take no thought for your life, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor yet for your body, what you shall put on. Is not life more than meat, and the body more than raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They have no jobs, neither do they make cloth. And yet I say to you that even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these." Jesus goes on to say that what will make his disciples different from all the nations of the world is that we do not worry about material needs. Instead, we learn from him how to do something called living by faith. This concept of living by faith is the core of Jesus' message to the world. He says that our Creator never intended for us to put our faith in money. He wants us to put our faith in him, to work for him, and to trust him to provide our material needs. Yet this simple message of faith has been missed by virtually everyone. We praise Jesus as supposedly being the Son of God, yet we live our lives as though God does not even exist, as though all that really makes the world go round is money. Money, money. Later in the 12th chapter of his gospel, Matthew records Jesus lamenting the fact that the world refused to heed his warnings and to welcome his message. Hardly anyone was prepared to trust his promise of heavenly provision. He says, "The queen of the south shall rise up in judgment with this generation, and she shall condemn them. For she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, one greater than Solomon is here." Notice that in both of these passages, one from the very heart of the Sermon on the Mount, and one from the 12th chapter of Matthew, Jesus makes reference to King Solomon. He says that what he has to offer is greater than what Solomon had to offer. So what did Solomon have to offer? Well, he was famous for having built the first temple in Jerusalem, a structure of great beauty and even greater wealth. The records show that Solomon had literally tons of gold, tens of tons of gold. But he's also famous for his wisdom. He was regarded as being the wisest man ever to have lived. But Jesus has contrasted Solomon's wealth and Solomon's wisdom with his own vision of relative poverty and a dramatically different type of wisdom. He compares the simplicity and beauty of birds and flowers with all that Solomon was able to buy or make using silver and gold. Then he makes this strange reference to the Queen of the South, the Queen of Sheba. In doing that, he directs our attention to a story which appears twice in the Old Testament, once in the 10th chapter of 1 Kings, and once in the 9th chapter of 2 Chronicles. In this story, the Queen of Sheba comes to Solomon with more than 4 tons of gold as a gift, just for the privilege of hearing his great wisdom. She valued his wisdom that highly. By comparison, what have we done with the message and the wisdom of Jesus? A message which contrasts so dramatically with Solomon's great wealth. We have walked on it, trampling it beneath our feet as we continue to seek earthly wealth and Solomon's inferior wisdom. Jesus called this simple message of living by faith seeking God's kingdom and seeking God's righteousness. He says that if we would only do that, instead of seeking more and more money, our other basic material needs will be supplied by God, our Creator and Heavenly Father. And in the process, we will discover peace and happiness as well. Eternal life, life in all its fullness. This is the essence of the Sermon on the Mount, the essence of the teachings of Jesus, the essence of the Bible, and the essence of God's revelation to mankind. But my topic in this video was to have been the mark of the beast. And so far, in what I have observed about Jesus, there's been no mention of this mysterious mark, has there? So let's return to the Revelation now for a closer look at what it says about the mark of the beast. But I just want to remind you that the proper title of that final book of the Bible is this: The Revelation of Jesus Christ. So what I'm looking for here is a link between that ultimate revelation in the Sermon on the Mount and what it is that this final book of the Bible is trying to tell us. Here it is, in the 13th chapter of the Revelation. He, that is, the Antichrist, the beast, the devil in human form, causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, so that no one will be able to buy or sell except those who have the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that has understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Here is wisdom. There's that word again, wisdom. The same word that Jesus used when he contrasted himself with Solomon. We saw that Solomon's wisdom led to great material wealth. But Jesus started that great Sermon on the Mount with such opposite words. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Do you want wisdom? Real wisdom? Jesus says that it is to be found in something that Solomon missed. Jesus' wisdom is the ultimate good side. And the Revelation says to study that number 666 to find out where all the ultimate bad stuff comes from. The prophecy adds a clue. It says that 666 is the number of a man. Many years ago, I found a huge Bible concordance, the biggest I've ever seen, and I did a search for that number, 666. It occurred to me that the same number might actually appear somewhere else in the Bible. In the Revelation, God urges us to study the number, to link it with a man if we want to discover true wisdom. And sure enough, I found that the number 666 appears in two other places in the Bible. I found it in the 10th chapter of 1 Kings, and I found it in the 9th chapter of 2 Chronicles, the very same chapters that Jesus had referred to in the 12th chapter of Matthew when he contrasted his wisdom with that of Solomon. Here it is, virtually the same words in both chapters. And the amount of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. That's a lot of gold. In fact, it's approximately 25 tons of gold. At today's gold prices, that would be well over $8 billion in 1 year, making Solomon one of the richest men who has ever lived, on a par with Bill Gates. I believe that there will yet arise another great king in the earth, the letters of whose name will in Hebrew add up to 666, according to the numeric value of the letters in it. But in the meantime, the prototype for that king is revealed in Scripture to be none other than King Solomon himself. Jesus was hinting at that when he contrasted his wisdom on those two occasions with that of Solomon. What Jesus said about wisdom and what the Mark of the Beast prophecy says about wisdom both point to the same two chapters of the Bible. Ah, but you say Solomon was a good man. He was the king of Israel. He even wrote three books of the Bible: the Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes. True, but is he the Son of God? Do you see how important it is for us to look beyond good men and beyond the Bible to the Word made flesh himself if we want true wisdom? The prosperity gospel, that curse upon the so-called Christian church around the world today, where did it come from? Did it not come from the so-called wisdom of Solomon? They rejected Jesus and his blessings upon the poor, to promote their false gospel of materialism. More and more glitz, more and more shiny toys, all of which only mirror their own spiritual emptiness. A gospel spawned by the demons of hell, and they hold up Solomon as their replacement for Jesus. They have crucified Jesus that they might be rich. They have trampled on the Son of God for the ashes of wealth, and their demonic teaching that material gain is proof of godliness. There is no joy in their superficiality. There is no peace in their quest for more and more, for they are in the grip of the beast himself, just waiting for him to give them his mark. Yes, Jesus predicted the mark of the beast, but he did more than that. Through his life and through his teachings, he prepared his disciples to live without it. He calls on us to be content with food and clothing, going into all the world to preach the good news of God's blessings on the poor. We're getting ready, brothers and sisters, ready for his glorious reappearing. But first, we must go through the greatest trouble that the world has ever known. And we will go through it by the power of his might, walking in his wisdom, and building on the solid rock of his teachings. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. Amen.
That was A Voice in the Desert, Solomon and the Mark of the Beast. Time to sign off now. Thank you very much to all of... Time to sign off now. Apologies that we haven't got Martin Summers or Dave Bazanko mixing this show or chatting on this show. That's the way it is, I'm afraid, through most of April. Hopefully back in May, as Dave gets back from his holidays, we'll be back to normal. You can hear Martin and I knocking spots off each other. You can download the MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll find the podcast, full-length interviews, story clicks, links, comment page, and our email addresses. My paperbacks about deals between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, costs £15. Also my secret government anthology From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination, that's the Siege of Heaven Reader. They're both on eBay. The second of those two books is £20. It's quite a big, fat kind of coffee table book, really. And it's really an anthology with a few notes by me in there. All sorts of interesting stuff by other people, not by me. And you can get the Siege of Heaven ebook, which is a compilation of my articles, including up-to-date ones, too. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. We're also on over Sunday breakfast at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. Please do make live recordings. We've been streaming from the People's Republic of Soapscroft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can stream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join me for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
through eating too much supper before I went to bed. Strange thoughts came on my slumber, strange thoughts came in my head. This world seemed topsy-turvy, and people of renown were doing the most peculiar things as the world turned upside down. I dreamt there was no workhouse, and there were no starving poor, and nations never did quarrel, nor never went to war. I thought all men were angels, and women ne'er wore a frown. Old maids, they had large families, as the world turned upside down.